Chapter 3. The Africans. In understanding Black Africa, geography is more important than history. Fernand Braudel. In a strictly geographical sense, all the peoples on the continent of Africa are Africans, from the whites of South Africa to the Arabs of the Mediterranean states. But the term has in practice come to refer primarily to the indigenous peoples of Africa below the Sahara, to Black Africans. The basis for this focus is not simply racial, but historic, cultural, and geographic as well. As with the British, the Slavs, and others, the influence of geography in Africa has not been simply in its effects primarily on things, natural resources or economic prosperity, for example, but on people. More specifically, the effect of geography in making cultural interactions more difficult has been particularly striking as between the peoples of sub-Saharan Africa and the outside world, as well as among themselves. To their north is a desert more vast than the continental United States, and to the east, west, and south are the Indian, Atlantic, and Antarctic oceans. Moreover, the smooth coastline of sub-Saharan Africa has offered few harbors which ocean-going ships could enter, and in many places the shallow coastal waterways have meant that large ships could not get near the shores. Ironically, for centuries, much of the world's international trade was carried in ships that sailed past West Africa on their way between Europe and Asia around the southern tip of the continent. Seldom did they stop. Partly, this was a result of wind and ocean currents that made return trips between Europe and sub-Saharan Africa difficult, or not economically feasible, in the era of wind-driven ships, at least until far greater knowledge of those currents and of alternative routes developed. Relatively little of Africa's trade entered international commerce. In the era before the modern transportation revolution of railroads, automobiles, and planes, which is to say, throughout most of human history, the geographical barriers surrounding tropical Africa have been formidable, though not absolutely impenetrable. The consequences have been not only economic, but cultural. As the eminent French historian Fernand Braudel put it, external influence filtered only very slowly, drop by drop, into the vast African continent south of the Sahara. The geographic barriers to economic and cultural exchanges within various regions of sub-Saharan Africa have been formidable as well. The most striking of these barriers has been a dearth of navigable rivers or streams, though the land itself also presents difficult terrain in many places in the form of escarpments and rift valleys. The net effect has been that the peoples of sub-Saharan Africa have historically been insulated not only from the peoples and cultures of the outside world, but also from one another. Among the cultural consequences has been a linguistic fragmentation of tropical Africa, which has made African languages one-third of all the languages of the world, even though African peoples are only about 10% of the world's population. This linguistic fragmentation has been only one aspect of cultural fragmentation in general, including tribalism and many religious differences. In addition, a substantial portion of peoples of African ancestry today, 60 million, live in the Western Hemisphere, where they have absorbed the languages and cultures of Europeans. The imprint of Islamic civilization is also visible over large areas of sub-Saharan Africa, with the northern regions of some contemporary African states such as Nigeria, Sudan, and Tanzania being Islamic and the southern part Christian or traditional in religion, with both non-African religions reflecting the influences of past conquerors. Black Africans became conquered peoples in two very different senses in different parts of the world, by territorial conquests and by massive enslavement. The conquerors and enslavers included other Africans, Arabs, and Europeans. Like so much of the history of Africa, these tragic events have been heavily influenced by the geography of the continent. Africa. In much of sub-Saharan Africa, a combination of geographic features has had unfavorable, if not devastating, consequences for economic and cultural development, and tragic consequences for the vulnerability of Black Africans to outside conquerors. The natural environment. One of the remarkable facts about the African continent is that, Despite being much larger than the continent of Europe, its coastline is shorter than the European coastline. Indeed, shorter than the coastline of any other continent, even though Africa is second only to Asia in size. This anomaly reflects Africa's lack of the numerous coastal indentations which form natural harbors in Europe, providing places where ships can dock, sheltered from the rough waters of the open seas, thereby enabling European countries to become maritime nations early in their history. In addition to a dearth of harbors, parts of sub-Saharan Africa have shallow coastal waters, so that maritime trade has often had to be conducted by the costly method of having ships anchor offshore, with their cargoes being unloaded onto smaller vessels, which could then make their way to land through these shallow waters. Africans have generally not been seafaring peoples, except in the Mediterranean or in parts of East Africa where these geographic constraints have not been as severe. Much of Africa, and especially sub-Saharan Africa, has developed without the benefits of a large maritime trade and the consequent stimulus of economic and cultural interchanges on a large scale with various and disparate peoples. While there has been for centuries some trade between sub-Saharan Africa and Europe, or with the peoples of North Africa and the Middle East, international trade has generally played a relatively smaller part in the total trade of Africa as compared to other continents, not only because of a dearth of harbors, but also because of a dearth of navigable rivers reaching into the interior of the continent from the sea. River mouths opening into the sea have been blocked by sandbars in some places, and in other places the few good harbors have been connected to hinterlands that were not very productive and so have had little to offer in trade. Thin coastal plains, averaging only 20 miles in width and often backed by steep escarpments, have likewise provided little basis for large-scale international trade, even where other conditions might permit it. Low and irregular rainfall over many parts of Africa fill rivers and streams to a navigable depth only intermittently, and even when filled, many rivers and streams are navigable only by smaller boats or barges, not ocean-going vessels. Where the volume of water is sufficient for navigation by sizable vessels, the many rapids and waterfalls of Africa still impede international trade. The Zaire River, for example, is 2,900 miles long and has a volume of water second only to that of the Amazon, but its rapids and waterfalls near the sea prevent ocean-going ships from reaching inland. Thus, the role played by other great rivers of the world in facilitating the development of ports that became great cities, contributing to the economic and cultural development of the surrounding lands and peoples, was denied the Zaire by the intractable facts of geography. Nor is the Zaire unique among Africa's rivers. No river in sub-Saharan Africa reaches from the open sea to deep into the interior. On the Mediterranean coast, only the Nile reaches far inland. Significantly, the Nile spawned the most famous of the civilizations developed on the African continent, as well as the two largest cities on the continent, Cairo and Alexandria. Except for the Nile, Africa's rivers that are even seasonally navigable tend to be concentrated in equatorial West Africa, which has produced larger and more advanced societies than in many other tropical regions of the continent. In short, the peoples of Africa, like the peoples of Europe and Asia, tended to develop urban centers and larger cultural universes around navigable waterways. There have simply been far fewer of them in Africa, which has been and remains the world's least urbanized continent. Among the relatively few things which have had sufficiently concentrated value in a relatively small physical size so as to be able to repay the high costs of transport from Africa have historically been gold, ivory, and slaves. All three became major exports. The coast of what is now Nigeria became known as the Slave Coast, just as the coast of neighboring Ghana to the west was called the Gold Coast, and that west of Ghana was, and still is, called the Ivory Coast. One indicator of differences in access to waterways is that, while more than a third of Europe's landmass consists of islands and peninsulas, only 2% of Africa's landmass consists of islands and peninsulas. Such disparities in access to waterways are accentuated when the navigability of these waterways is also taken into account. Even the Niger River, the heart of a great river system in West Africa, draining an area nearly twice the size of Texas, is not navigable everywhere by large vessels, and is not navigable at all in some places because of rapids. At the height of the rainy season, the Niger may become a 20-mile-wide moving lake, but during the dry season, the average depth of the Niger can in places fall below 4 meters. Despite its serious limitations, the Niger compares favorably with other African rivers with even more serious limitations. The Niger has been characterized as the easiest to navigate in all of tropical Africa. Navigating the Niger's chief tributary, the Benue River, for example, has been more problematical. Because of seasonal rainfall patterns, the upper Benue has been navigable only 2 months of the year, leading to hectic and complicated shipping patterns. If they let the craft stay up the Benue a day too long, the vessels will be stuck on sandbars for 10 months. Yet if through caution or misinformation they withdraw the fleet too soon, much valuable merchandise is left behind and can only be evacuated by land at much greater cost. The first boats to go in are the commercial canoes, then follow the larger craft, and finally, when there is sufficient water at Lokoja, the largest power craft and their barges sail up the river as fast as possible. Towards the end of the short season, the large craft have to come out first because of the fall in the level of the water. The medium-sized craft follow, and the small canoes may continue for some time evacuating small quantities of produce. Drastic changes in water level are common in other West African rivers and streams. The Senegal River has been characterized as precariously navigable, and only during some months at that. Like the Niger, the Senegal is not only subject to large seasonal changes in water flow, but also contains rocks and rapids. In East Africa, such rivers as the Zambezi are navigable only for relatively short stretches. One reason for the drastic seasonal changes in water levels in African rivers is that tropical Africa is one of the few large regions of the world without a single mountain range to collect snow, whose later melting would supplement rainfall in maintaining the flow of streams and rivers. Rivers in tropical Africa are wholly dependent on rainfall, and that rainfall is itself highly undependable, not only from one season to another, but also from one year to the next. The term navigable can, of course, mean many things. In some of the rivers of Angola, for example, it means navigable by boats requiring no more than 8 feet of water, and in parts of West Africa during the dry season, even the Niger will carry barges weighing no more than 8 tons. By contrast, ships weighing 10,000 tons can go hundreds of miles up the Yangtze River in China, and smaller vessels another 1,000 miles beyond that. Aircraft carriers can go up the Hudson River and dock at a pier in mid-Manhattan. Navigable rivers in Africa seldom mean anything approaching that. Even the Nile was unable to handle the largest vessels in Roman times. Moreover, because so much of tropical Africa consists of high plateaus, almost the entire continent is more than 1,000 feet above sea level, and half the continent is more than 2,500 feet above sea level, African rivers must plunge greater vertical distances to reach the sea, making them less navigable en route. While the Amazon River falls only about 20 feet during its last 500 miles to the sea, the Zaire River drops about 1,000 feet in 250 miles as it approaches the sea. As a geographer has put it, the African continent is cursed with a mesa form which converts nearly every river into a plunging torrent. However impenetrable much of the interior of sub-Saharan Africa may have been to large ocean-going ships, the continent's coastal waters have been plied by smaller boats, which could and did go inland as well, being unloaded and carried around waterfalls. Shipments from ocean-going vessels could also be loaded onto smaller craft for transportation into the interior on rivers. Local waterborne traffic between inland locations was likewise possible by carrying boats and their cargoes around rapids and waterfalls. Sometimes these boats and cargoes were carried from one river to another, thereby expanding the reach of commerce. For example, an overland route requiring 25 days of porterage on land connected the Niger and the Senegal rivers in centuries past. Moreover, Even rivers beset with cascades and waterfalls may have navigable stretches that add up to considerable distances, hundreds of miles on the Senegal and more than 1,500 on the Zaire, even though these are not continuous distances. Thus, the various regions of Africa were not hermetically sealed off from one another or from the outside world, but both the volume and the variety of trade, as well as the distances involved, were nevertheless severely curtailed in comparison with more geographically fortunate regions of the world, where heavy and bulky cargoes of coal, ores, and grain could be shipped long distances in continuous river and ocean voyages. A late 20th century comparison of the transportation costs of grain in several Asian and African nations found that these transport costs were a higher proportion of the total price paid for grain by consumers in Africa. Moreover, such statistics do not capture the effect of transport costs on grain that was never shipped in the first place, precisely because higher shipping costs would have made it prohibitively expensive. Contemporary transport costs also cannot capture the handicaps created by even higher transport costs in Africa before many of the transportation advances from the rest of the world were introduced in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and before African harbors could be dredged by modern European equipment and Western railroads built. While it is true, as an historian has said, that a considerable portion of West Africa was part of a hydrographic system that was ultimately connected to the Atlantic, the limitations of that system are a part of the story that cannot be omitted without serious distortion. Moreover, the distances between the interior hinterlands and the open seas are greater in Africa than in Europe, for example, while the means of covering those distances are much more limited by geography in Africa. In Europe, no part of the continent outside of Russia is more than 500 miles from the sea, but a substantial part of tropical Africa is more than 500 miles from the sea, and a portion is more than 1,000 miles from the sea. Only Asia has a larger interior area remote from the sea, though Asia has more navigable rivers connecting its interior with the coast. The geographical positions of African rivers must also be taken into account. Although the Niger River originates just 200 miles from the Atlantic Ocean, it circles far inland before eventually turning back toward the sea, and covers 2,600 miles before actually reaching the ocean. In general, the tenuous connection of the African interior with the sea has been one of the major geographical barriers to the economic, cultural, and political development of the continent south of the Sahara. Land transportation in large regions of sub-Saharan Africa has also been made more difficult because of the prevalence of the tsetse fly, which has carried a fatal sickness that has affected animals as well as human beings, and made the use of pack animals and draft animals impracticable in many places. Denied this aid to land transportation, Africans often carried bundles on their heads in colorful caravans that were reflections of the bleak alternatives left to them without the help of either the waterways or the animal power available to other peoples on other continents. Expensive transportation provided by human beings limited what could be carried, how far it could be carried, and how fast. In addition to the physical limitations, there were narrower limits imposed by economics as to what items contained enough value in a relatively small space to repay the costs of this expensive method of transport. The lack of animals' muscle power in tropical Africa has been felt not only in transportation, but also in farming. A dearth of draft animals in farming often meant not only a loss of muscle power, but also a dearth of fertilizer. The latter has been especially important in those parts of the continent where soils have been very much in need of fertilizer, because their low nutrient content and proneness to erosion meant that their fertility was easily exhausted by cultivation. Rainfall patterns in parts of Africa, long dry spells followed by torrential downpours, increase erosion since dry, baked soil is more easily washed away. Moreover, these torrential tropical downpours tend to leach the nutrients from the soil in Africa, as in many other tropical regions. Finally, the tropics provide a disease environment in which many more deadly diseases may flourish than in temperate zones, or in mountainous tropical regions that have more temperate climates because of their heights. For example, 90% of all deaths from malaria in the world occur in sub-Saharan Africa. Even a listing of individual geographical disadvantages in Africa may understate the handicap they represent in combination. For example, the problem of poor water transportation, while serious in itself, is still more serious in combination with poor land transportation across much difficult terrain without the aid of pack animals. The highly variable rainfall patterns become more serious in view of where the rain falls. A geographical study of Africa found plenty of water available where it cannot be used, and a scarcity where it is most needed. Not all parts of sub-Saharan Africa have suffered all these disabilities simultaneously. However, the fragile fertility in some regions of tropical Africa has meant that a given territory would not permanently feed people at a given location, and this in turn meant that those people had to move on every few years to find new land that would feed them, while the land they left behind recovered its fertility. Therefore, whole societies had to be mobile, foregoing the opportunities to build territorially based communities with permanent structures, such as other Africans built in more geographically favored parts of the continent, and which were common in Europe, Asia, and the Western Hemisphere. The provincialism of isolated peoples has not been peculiar to Africa. What has been peculiar to Africa are the geographic barriers to mobility that have pervaded vast areas below the Sahara. Waterways extend the boundaries of cultural interchange, but in much of sub-Saharan Africa, they did not extend those cultural boundaries very far. Like other places relatively isolated from broader cultural developments, the Scottish Highlands, parts of the Balkans, or the South Sea Islands, for example, much of sub-Saharan Africa tended to lag behind the technological, organizational, and economic progress in other parts of the world. A lack of literacy throughout most of sub-Saharan Africa further limited both internal development and the stimulus of contacts with distant times and places via the written word. While similar retardation afflicted particular parts of Europe or Asia, or isolated island communities around the world, in Africa, such cultural isolation characterized wide areas and many peoples. The degree of these cultural handicaps has varied in different parts of the continent and has changed over time. Railroads, motor transport, and airplanes have all added to transportation possibilities, and electronic communication media, from cheap radios to television, have penetrated cultural isolation. But all this has happened within a recent, minute fraction of human history, long after great cultural differences had developed among peoples with geographically restricted cultures, and between them and others with more ample access to wider cultural worlds. Moreover, even in modern times, the sharp changes in altitude of the African landscape continued to make both roads and railroads difficult to build. The rail line from Djibouti to Addis Ababa, for example, rises more than 2,000 feet in its first 60 miles and more than 4,600 feet in its last 180 miles. Given the multiple and formidable geographical obstacles to its economic and cultural development, Africa's poverty is hardly surprising. This poverty, over much of sub-Saharan Africa, is shown in many ways. Lower incomes per capita are an obvious indicator, though the complexities of international exchange rates make these statistics questionable as measures of relative standards of living. However, when the monetary value of output per capita in Nigeria is less than 2% of that in the United States, and in Tanzania less than 1%, that clearly cannot all be due to exchange rates. A more meaningful picture of differences in living standards is that average life expectancies are typically more than 70 years in Europe, Australia, the United States, Canada, and Japan, while average life expectancies in sub-Saharan Africa tend to be in the 50s or even the 40s. Moreover, even these life expectancies in Africa have been achieved only with the help of medical and public health measures originating elsewhere in the world. Within this general picture of lagging economic development in much of Africa, there have been historic and continuing variations in economic development and political organization among the various regions of the continent. One of the more fortunate regions of sub-Saharan Africa, from various perspectives, has been Equatorial West Africa, what is today Nigeria, Ghana, and their neighboring states. This region has some of the continent's more fertile soil, ample rainfall, and the Niger River system. Here, some of the larger African kingdoms arose. However, even in this relatively more favored region of Africa, the states and even empires that arose were often small by world standards. The Oyo Empire, in what is today Nigeria, covered an estimated 150,000 square kilometers, which is smaller than the American state of Colorado. The Songhai Empire, which included the rich river valleys of the central and western Sudan, was about the size of France, which is to say, smaller than Texas. Yet these were huge states by African standards, since most Africans lived in polities only a fraction as large, with national populations no larger than the populations of cities or even towns in the rest of the world. In Africa, as in other parts of the world, those peoples who were more fortunate often used their advantages to subjugate others. In West Africa, this subjugation took the form both of conquest and of enslavement of fellow Africans. Across the Sahara, in North Africa, more favorable geographic conditions, including harbors on the Mediterranean, also led to larger and more advanced societies. These, too, used their advantages to subjugate and enslave sub-Saharan Africans. In East Africa, some of the more geographically favored areas included harbors, such as the large natural harbor on the offshore island of Zanzibar, and such mainland ports as Mombasa and Kilwa. All three became major centers for the trading and shipment of slaves, usually captured from less fortunate inland tribes. Here, the enslavers were typically either Arabs or people of mixed Arab and African ancestry and culture, known as Swahilis. Slavery. Slavery was not unique to Africa or Africans, but was in fact common on every inhabited continent for thousands of years. As recently as the 18th century, it existed in Eastern Europe, and it continued to exist in the Middle East after the Second World War. What was unusual about Africa was the magnitude of the trade in human beings within recent centuries. Within Africa itself, slaves were used for a wide variety of tasks and under a wide variety of social arrangements. The classic plantation slavery of the Western Hemisphere was much less common in sub-Saharan Africa, and some of the forms of slavery shaded off into paternalistic incorporation of slaves into extended kinship with the slave-owning family, leading some to question whether this should be classified as slavery. However, such paternalistic arrangements were at one end of a spectrum that included brutal subjugation and even using slaves as human sacrifices. In some parts of Africa, such as Egypt, the Sudan, and Zanzibar, Africans were in fact plantation slaves on a large scale. Even where they were not plantation slaves, however, they often nevertheless lived separately from the free population, rather than in the kinds of paternalistic domestic living arrangements that existed elsewhere. In these other non-domestic occupations, mortality rates could be very high, as in Tanganyika and Zaire. The proportions of slaves in the general population varied, ranging from a minority to a majority, even in a given region, such as the Sudan or Nigeria. Most African slaves remained in Africa. Indeed, those captured in the Sudan remained in the Sudan, and those captured in Nigeria remained in Nigeria. But the numbers exported were still enormous. In the middle of the 16th century, the total number of slaves exported from Africa was between 10,000 and 20,000 annually. 2 centuries later, the number peaked at about 100,000 annually. Origins and destinations of slaves also changed dramatically. The bulk of the mid-16th century slaves were exported from the northern savannah and the Horn of Africa. But sometime after the middle of the 17th century, the west coast of Africa became the principal supplier of slaves, a position it was to hold for another 100 years, as the European demand for slaves in the Western Hemisphere overtook the demand for slaves in the Islamic countries of the Middle East and North Africa. The magnitude of the slave exports from Africa is particularly striking in view of the relatively thin population of the continent then, as now. The population of West Africa, where most of the Western Hemisphere slaves originated, has been estimated as about 11 million people at the beginning of the 16th century, increasing to about 20 million by the beginning of the 19th century. In some parts of Africa, such as the region of Angola and the Congo, Enslavement was on a scale that exceeded the natural increase of population and resulted in depopulations of villages. In addition, the massive movements of captured people overland entailed a spread of disease. Cholera and smallpox, for example, followed the routes of the slave trade in East Africa. Markets for food and other provisions for the slave trade also grew up along its routes. The Arabs took more women than men, partly to fill the harems of the Ottoman Empire and other Islamic lands, so that the societies left in the African savanna tended to have an excess of men and children. The Atlantic slave trade took more men than women, using slaves principally for plantation labor, so that the West African societies from which slaves were taken had an excess of women and children. In both places, the resulting sex imbalance in African societies led to a revision of traditional sex roles, including an increase of polygyny in West Africa. In both areas, slaves were mostly young adults, so that the slave populations were atypical of the general African population, nearly one-half of which consisted of children. By the time the Europeans discovered the Western Hemisphere at the end of the 15th century, Muslim merchants already dominated the slave trade in West Africa, as they did in East Africa and North Africa. The Islamic jihads of the 18th and 19th centuries created new Muslim states in West Africa, which in turn promoted enslavement on a larger scale. Altogether, between 1650 and 1850, at least 5 million slaves were shipped from West Africa alone. Inland tribes, such as the Igbo, were regularly raided by their more powerful coastal neighbors, and the captives led away to be sold as slaves. European merchants who came to buy slaves in West Africa were confined by rulers in these countries to a few coastal ports, where Africans could bring slaves and trade as a cartel in order to get higher prices. Hundreds of miles farther south, in the Portuguese colony of Angola, hundreds of thousands of Africans likewise carried out the initial captures, enslavement, and slave trading processes, funneling the slaves into the major marketplaces where the Portuguese took charge of them and shipped them off to Brazil. Most of the slaves shipped across the Atlantic were purchased, rather than captured, by Europeans. Arabs, however, captured their own slaves and penetrated far deeper into Africa than Europeans dared venture, before the era of modern medicine provided the latter with some protection against the fatal tropical diseases for which they lacked biological resistance. Over the centuries, untold millions of human beings from sub-Saharan Africa were transported in captivity to other parts of the world. No exact statistics exist covering all sources and all destinations, and scholarly estimates vary. However, over the centuries, somewhere in the neighborhood of 11 million people were shipped across the Atlantic as slaves, and another 14 million African slaves were sent to the Islamic nations of the Middle East and North Africa. On both routes, many died in transit. Moreover, these 25 million people were not the only African victims of slavery, for Africa itself used large numbers of slaves in many agricultural, domestic, military, and even commercial and governmental enterprises. The sum total of all the human beings who fell victim to the institution of slavery will never be known, even for Africa, much less for the world in general. The ending of the slave trade was one of many European policies imposed upon Africa by the conquerors. This did not mean the immediate freeing of existing slaves. Simply stopping the trading of slaves was itself a monumental undertaking, lasting for at least a century. As for the freeing of existing slaves, resistance and evasion by Africans, and especially by Arabs, made this a much more protracted process in Africa and the Middle East than in the Western Hemisphere. The very phrases used in these different parts of the world reflect their very different histories. While emancipation was usually a specific event at a specific time in the countries of the Western Hemisphere, the decline of slavery was a much longer and more uneven process in Africa, where slaves were still widely held in the early decades of the 20th century. In some Islamic countries in Africa and the Middle East, slavery lasted even longer. Saudi Arabia, Mauritania, and the Sudan continued to hold slaves on past the middle of the 20th century. Mauritania officially abolished slavery in 1980, though its own government admitted that the practice continued nevertheless, Indeed, Mauritanian government officials themselves have been implicated, and more than a decade later, 30,000 black Africans were still being held as slaves in Mauritania, often under brutal conditions. On a smaller scale, slavery persisted in some other African countries on the eve of the 21st century. In one of the backwaters of Ghana, under local customs, some offenses required restitution in the form of turning over a virgin from the offending family to be a sex slave. Estimates of the number of girls involved run into the thousands. Commercial exploitation of young slaves also had not died out completely as a new millennium approached. Trading in children is a common practice in both Benin and Nigeria, the New York Times reported in August 1997. Economic history. Because written records were unknown throughout most of pre-colonial black Africa, much of its history is lost, except as preserved in oral traditions, in the writings of Arabs or Europeans, or in the researches and surmises of archaeologists and anthropologists. Nevertheless, enough is known to dispel some common misconceptions about Africa. The peoples of Africa were not simply hunters and gatherers of the spontaneous produce of nature. Agriculture existed for centuries before the Europeans came. So did animal husbandry, in areas where the tsetse fly did not make it impossible. Iron, gold, and salt were likewise produced in Africa many centuries before the white man came, and in the late Middle Ages, Africa became Europe's principal source of gold. Cloth and clothing were manufactured in Africa more than 1,000 years before European colonization in the 19th century. And, while Africa later imported European cloth, it also exported its own cloth to Europe. Nor did the economy remain stagnant or unaffected by new options presented through outside contacts with Europe, Asia, or the Middle East. Many crops now regarded as traditional in Africa originated in Europe, Asia, or the Western Hemisphere, including cocoa, peanuts, and tobacco. Most of the rice grown in West Africa today was indigenous to Asia. Both local and long-distance trade existed in pre-colonial Africa, though within severe constraints imposed by geography. Caravans were one adaptation to these constraints, providing mobile marketplaces covering long distances, though at a slow pace that could take months for a round trip. International trade extended to the Arab states, to Europe, and to India. Nevertheless, Africa's general level of development and standard of living were well below those of Europe. However, the relationships of Africans to Europeans did not remain static, but changed very substantially over the centuries. In the early centuries of European explorations along the coasts of tropical West Africa, the balance of power was by no means so decisively on the side of the Europeans as it would become in later centuries. A 15th-century standoff between a Portuguese warship and African coastal boats with fighting men was indicative. The weapons of the Portuguese ship were not particularly effective against either the more maneuverable African boats or against the African coast, while the Africans were unable to board the high-hulled Portuguese ship. The two sides ended up trading peacefully, as many other Europeans and Africans of this era did. European firearms at this point were still primitive, inaccurate, and slow-firing, giving them no substantial advantages over bows and arrows or spears. Freebooting European marauders raided African coastal settlements for booty and captured people to enslave, but the larger European governments saw such activity as impediments to trade and sought to suppress it. Moreover, the Africans themselves were often able to fight off marauders, so that peaceful trade became the rule between Europeans and the peoples of the African coast during this era. This trade was controlled and regulated by African rulers, who were able to suspend it or terminate it whenever it suited their purposes. Not surprisingly, European traders often exchanged gifts with those who ruled in Africa in order to remain on good terms and continue trading. This trade was not necessarily in products not available in Africa. Senegambia, for example, imported approximately 150 tons of steel annually from Europe, but steel of comparable quality was being produced in Africa, though its cost in Senegambia was high because it had to be transported over land, while steel arrived from Europe by water. Even when military action was taken by Europeans in Africa during this era, it was often with the help of African allies. When the Portuguese fought without such allies, they were more than once defeated and massacred. Slaves were among the main commodities traded during this era, which preceded the era of European territorial conquests in sub-Saharan Africa. This trade was, like other trade, largely under the firm control of African rulers, and it too was suspended whenever this suited the interests of those rulers. By the time, centuries later, when the balance of power swung decisively against the Africans, the vast Atlantic slave trade no longer existed. The slave trade with the Western Hemisphere had been virtually annihilated before the European scramble for Africa began in the 1880s, and slavery itself was banned by all Western Hemisphere nations by 1888, when Brazil became the last of these nations to emancipate slaves. Several factors influenced the belated efforts of European imperialist powers to conquer Africa, centuries after they had conquered the Western Hemisphere. Perhaps the most decisive difference between the two conquests was the simple fact that disease was an enormously powerful ally of the Europeans in their conquests of the American Indians, who died in great numbers from the spread of diseases from Europe, while disease was an enormously powerful ally of the Africans in resisting European incursions. With the passing centuries, however, the use of quinine and other medical advances enabled Europeans to live in, and therefore to conquer, tropical regions. Meanwhile, the progress of European weaponry, especially the use of rifling and gun barrels to increase accuracy, turned the balance of military power decisively against those with spears or bows and arrows. At the same time, the Industrial Revolution created vastly increased amounts of wealth, from which European governments could easily obtain the resources required for expensive campaigns of imperial expansion, while the absence of such developments in much of the rest of the world made for a huge disparity in power that promoted European imperialism. The readiness with which the African continent succumbed to European colonial powers was one measure of this disparity. Even a small European country like Belgium, a pawn in Europe's power politics, could carve out a huge portion of Central Africa as its empire, calling it the Belgian Congo. Portugal, a country both small and relatively backward by European standards, had an even larger colonial empire in Africa. Major European powers like Britain and France took over African territory several times their own size. Not all this was achieved through sheer military power on the battlefield. On the contrary, both the conquerors and the conquered tended to minimize their losses by agreeing to some form of indirect rule, in which local authorities continued in their traditional roles, or in strengthened versions of those roles under European hegemony, while the imperial power made policy through them and influenced or controlled who could act as local authorities. However, such abrogations of African sovereignty were not agreed to merely by persuasion, bribery, or trickery. An obvious and enormous military disparity provided the context for such agreements. On those occasions when the military strength of the Europeans was directly confronted, the results were often disastrous for the Africans. When an outnumbered group of British troops defeated Ashanti warriors in 1873, inflicting far more casualties than they suffered, it was a pattern that was to be repeated elsewhere on the continent over the years. At the historic Battle of Omdurman, near Khartoum, in 1898, 20,000 British-led troops easily defeated 60,000 Sudanese, slaughtering many thousands and losing only a few hundred of their own soldiers. Smaller punitive expeditions similarly applied the Europeans' military superiority to secure African compliance. Not only European governments, but even private companies or groups of white settlers were able to seize control in various parts of Africa, primarily through the technological superiority of their weapons. Private groups of Arabs, likewise, set up their own little fiefdoms in parts of sub-Saharan Africa. Here and there, Africans won historic battles, but ultimately, the weight of technology, wealth, and organization were all against them, and ultimately they succumbed. In particular places, such as early 20th century Tanganyika, the fighting might be fierce for years, but such fighting often represented the all-out efforts of Africans against a minor portion of the manpower and firepower available to the Europeans. Where Europeans were not prepared to make larger commitments of men and resources to African colonization, a modus vivendi might be reached with the more formidable African forces, such as the Maasai in East Africa, as a prudent alternative to warfare. But the terms of such agreements, as they evolved over the years, extended European control, even if not always to total subjugation. In one way or another, virtually the entire continent of Africa was conquered by various European powers, in part because such conquest used up relatively little of these nations' total military or economic resources, rather than because of any great value of these African possessions. All sorts of special interests in Europe, missionaries, businessmen, politicians, or the military, had their own reasons to urge the creation and expansion of colonialism in Africa, but officials responsible for the public treasury were often opposed, viewing the matter in terms of financial costs and gains. In special cases, such as the Congo or South Africa, with their valuable mineral resources, the conquest might repay its costs, but these were exceptions rather than the rule. In a later era, when the costs of maintaining European rule became higher, whether in financial, military, or political terms, vast areas of Africa were abandoned as rapidly as they had once been conquered. Almost all the countries on this huge continent achieved independence within a span of 2 decades, beginning around the middle of the 20th century. While pre-colonial Africa had its own economic skills, institutions, and social patterns, the coming of European civilization nevertheless had a profound impact, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, where Europeans often introduced the plow, literacy, wheeled vehicles, and other fundamental advances, along with much suffering associated with conquest and continuing subjugation. The mere imposition of law and order, the cessation of intertribal warfare as the colonial powers established their hegemony over the contending Africans, had profound economic implications, as it once had in Roman Britain or later in Scotland. For example, land once too militarily vulnerable to cultivate could now be farmed. Thus, although whites seized vast amounts of land in Rhodesia, Africans there cultivated more of their own land than they had before the European conquests. European medicine, railroads, schools, and numerous commercial products also transformed Africa's economies and cultures. Europe's economic impact on Africa was far greater than Africa's economic effect on Europe. Contrary to various economic theories of imperialism, Africa was not a major outlet for European investment or exports. In the early 20th century, Britain's investments in Canada alone were larger than its investments in Africa and India put together, and more British money went to the United States than to Canada. France and Germany were likewise reluctant to sink much of their money into Africa. Commercial trade with Africa was similarly trivial for the economies of the European imperial powers. On the eve of the First World War, Germany exported more than 5 times as much to a small country like Belgium than to its own colonial empire, which was larger than Germany itself. France likewise exported 10 times as much to Belgium as to all its vast holdings in Africa. Out of Germany's total exports to the world, less than 1% went to its colonies in Africa. Africa was somewhat more significant to Europe as a source of imports, though most of these imports to Europe from Africa came from a relatively few places, such as the South African gold mines and diamond fields, or West Africa's cocoa and palm oil regions. Overall, Britain received less than 7% of its imports from Africa, less than from any other continent, including thinly populated Australia. Nor were African colonies usually important sources of profit to European investors or of revenue to European governments. German colonies, for example, in the years leading up to World War I, consistently absorbed expenditures greatly exceeding the revenues raised within the colonies, with taxpayers in Germany having to make up the difference. In the private economy, of 19 firms owning sisal plantations in German colonies, only 8 paid dividends. Only 4 out of 22 firms with cocoa plantations paid dividends, as did only 8 out of 58 rubber plantations, and only 3 out of 48 diamond mining companies. Viewed from Africa, however, the situation looked quite different. While trade with Africa was a small part of the total international trade of the European colonial powers, trade with these powers was a substantial portion of the total international trade of the African colonies. Moreover, African exports and imports grew substantially during the colonial era. In German East Africa, for example, exports of peanuts, rubber, cocoa, coffee, and sisal all grew several-fold in the relatively brief period from 1905 to 1913. Similarly, dramatic increases in exports from British, French, and Belgian colonies in Africa occurred between 1938 and 1958. Correspondingly, Africa had rising imports, as well as more consumption of locally produced goods, both raising the living standards of Africans. Real consumption in the Belgian Congo, for example, rose 77% in less than a decade, between 1950 and 1958. In addition, the European impact on colonial Africa included creation of virtually the whole modern industrial and commercial sectors of many African countries. Europeans also introduced new crops and new farming techniques, as well as creating the modern infrastructure of roads, harbor facilities, rail lines, telegraphs, motor transport, and the like. One small indication of what this meant economically is that a single railroad boxcar could carry as much freight as 300 human beings, the usual method of transport in much of Africa, and could cover in 2 days a distance that would take a caravan 2 months. In addition to the economic changes directly attributable to the European conquerors, the consolidation of vast regions of Africa under a new law and order encouraged large-scale immigration of entrepreneurial groups from India and Lebanon, and these Indians and Lebanese created new retail and even international trade networks in East and West Africa, respectively. So dominant did the Indians become over vast regions of East Africa that the rupee became the prevailing currency in much of that region. However, just as Indians and Lebanese settled in Africa mostly after European imperial rule was established there, so many of them departed or were forced out after colonial rule ended. In the meantime, however, they added greatly to the economic development of the African continent. These benefits were by no means without high costs. In addition to deaths from military action during the initial conquests, and often later suppressions of uprisings, there were numerous abuses, injustices, and even atrocities committed against Africans by the conquerors. Forced labor was one of the most widespread and most deeply resented of the chronic abuses to which conquered Africans were subjected. The conditions of this forced labor, like everything else, varied greatly from colony to colony and from time to time. Even among contract laborers, however, conditions could be dire. In the Portuguese colony of Angola, during the closing decades of the 19th century, no contract laborer who went to the offshore island of São Tomé was ever known to have returned alive. After an uprising of the Herero people in German Southwest Africa in 1904 had begun with a massacre of 123 Europeans, a German general ordered his soldiers to kill every Herero, armed or unarmed, whether men, women, or children. An estimated 60,000 out of the 80,000 Herero were in fact killed before the general was recalled to Berlin. Not all the conquests in sub-Saharan Africa were by Europeans or by nation-states. The great imbalance of power created by firearms enabled freelance adventurers, whether Arab or European, to move into the more isolated or backwards regions of the continent and carve out small empires for themselves, whether to seize and farm the land, like the Boers of southern Africa, or to collect tribute and slaves, as Arabs and Swahilis did farther north. These freelance conquests antedated the larger imperialism of European nation-states, which swallowed them up, along with African states and communities, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The most dramatic confrontation between these freelance empires and the new imperialism of European nation-states were the two Boer Wars, in which Britain imposed its rule on the existing independent republics that had been established by white settlers of predominantly Dutch ancestry, but who were no longer connected with the government of the Netherlands. The impact of European conquerors on Africa, for good and evil, was relatively brief as history is measured, about 3 generations, as compared to the centuries in which the Romans ruled Britain, or Imperial China ruled parts of Southeast Asia, or the Moors ruled Spain. Just as the 1880s saw the beginning of the European scramble for Africa, so the 1950s saw the beginning of their massive withdrawal. This withdrawal began in the northern tier of Muslim states in the 1950s, when Libya, Morocco, and Tunisia became independent, then spread rapidly southward over the next two decades as Nigeria, Tanzania, Uganda, the Congo, Kenya, and other black nations achieved their independence. Much as the withdrawal of Roman rule from Britain led to widespread retrogressions, so in many parts of Africa, the departure of the European rulers was followed by technological breakdowns, failing economies, and political chaos. African governments by the dozens were toppled by military coups in the post-independence era. The swift disappearance of newly attained democracy, as brutal dictatorships took over, led to the cynical phrase, "One man, one vote, one time." The elaborately fragmented peoples of Africa turned upon one another, sometimes with massive bloodbaths. Approximately 30,000 Igbos were slaughtered by Muslim mobs in Nigeria, 200,000 Hutus were slaughtered by the Tutsis in Burundi, and Idi Amin's regime slaughtered 300,000 people in Uganda. A continent once virtually self-sufficient in food, Africa became a massive importer of food as its own production faltered and in some places declined absolutely in the face of rising population. It was not uncommon for national output as a whole to decline absolutely for years in various African nations. In Equatorial Guinea, for example, the growth rate was negative for the decades of the 1970s and 1980s, averaging nearly -4% per annum for the 1980s and -9% for the 1970s. In Burundi, the annual growth rate of national output was -6% in 1994 and -18% in 1995, while in Rwanda, it ranged from -3.2% in 1992 to -50% in 1994. After the soaring rhetoric and optimistic expectations at the beginning of independence were followed by bitter disappointments and painful retrogressions that reached into virtually every aspect of African life, the immediate political response was not so much a reevaluation of the assumptions and policies which had led to such disastrous results, but instead a widespread blaming of the departed imperialists, or racial minorities such as the Indians, or even the United States, which has had relatively little role in African history, for good or ill. African nations. Over the centuries, African nations rose and fell like nations elsewhere around the world, the strong conquering the weak and either subjugating or enslaving those unable to resist. The Zulus, for example, invaded and conquered much of southern Africa in the 19th century, before the British arrived in 1879 to confront them and fight for control of the land. The first battle between them was won by the Zulus, leaving this scene of carnage on the battlefield. Two British drummer boys were hung up by their chins on butcher's hooks, their stomachs cut open like sheep. Most of the white men lay on their backs, with their hands clenched, their faces contorted in agony. Almost all of the more than 1,300 dead men had been disemboweled, turned on their backs, then slashed open with a spear from sternum to groin. Their intestines had spilled out onto the ground, where the Zulus' bare feet had smashed them, spreading a stinking ooze across the plain. A few men had been scalped, and some had been mutilated, their genitals cut off and stuffed into their mouths, or their lower jaw chopped off and taken away as bearded trophies of victory. Although the British ultimately prevailed over the Zulus, taking few prisoners, less than a generation later they had to fight two brutal wars for control of South Africa against their fellow Europeans, the Boers, a mixture of Dutch and other settlers who had landed in South Africa before them. In the Second Boer War, 26,000 Boer women and children perished in British concentration camps. Such were the grim realities of imperialism in Africa, whether the imperialists were black or white. The centuries-old conquest of the agricultural Hutu by the cattle-herding Tutsis left an even larger and longer-lasting legacy of carnage among these two African peoples. After Rwanda and Burundi became independent nations in the second half of the 20th century, the former under the Hutus and the latter under the Tutsis, in each country, the dominant group proceeded to massacre the other, setting off a cycle of slaughter, revenge, and mass refugee flight, whose end was still not in sight as the century neared its end. Nigeria. An estimated 1 out of every 5 Africans is a Nigerian. Nigeria has the largest black population of any nation on earth, followed by Ethiopia and the United States, and it is the 10th most populous nation in the world, with upwards of 80 million people. Like many African countries, Nigeria is composed of a variety of peoples with differing languages and religions, and as a nation is itself a creation of the colonial era. Its very name was suggested by a British journalist. The region of tropical West Africa that is now called Nigeria had a long and full history before the Europeans came. Iron was smelted in what is now Nigeria 5 centuries before Christ. Large, complex, indigenous political systems also arose in this region of West Africa. Towns and villages were common in this area, and about half the population lived in these urban communities before the beginning of the 20th century. In the 19th century, Nigeria was a British sphere of influence, and, in the 20th century, a British colony until independence was achieved in 1960. Britain became involved in Nigeria in stages, through a long series of ad hoc decisions in response to local and international events. Attempting to protect and advance a variety of British interests in the region without incurring the costs of administering a colony, the British found themselves drawn deeper and deeper into political involvements and military actions. Britain's historic decision to ban the international slave trade in the early 19th century entailed a large and long-running political and military commitment in West Africa, the source of most transatlantic slave shipments. Missionary, business, and other interests also promoted British involvement in the region. Nigeria was never a major British economic asset, however, nor a particularly desirable post for British colonial officials. Many of these officials, in fact, sought reassignment elsewhere at opportune moments. Britain's attempt to maintain a low-cost presence in the region led to a policy of governing through existing authorities, disturbing indigenous institutions, culture, and social systems as little as possible. Ironically, however, the very presence of the British undermined their attempt to maintain the status quo. The need for Nigerian clerks and other subordinates to help man the colonial administration required creating a new class of African people with education in the English language, with westernized concepts, and with experience in westernized ways of doing things. Moreover, different ethnic groups among the Africans had different degrees of receptivity to the new ways of doing things and responded differently to new opportunities to get ahead, leading to changed economic and social statuses among these groups compared to what their relative positions had been before the British arrived. Existing military power relationships among the tribes no longer mattered once the British had control of them all and would not permit them to fight. Moreover, it was now safe for people from one part of Nigeria to travel and even to settle in regions that were once enemy territory. Finally, the ease with which British power prevailed militarily created not only a respect, but also a mystique about things European and modern. However limited the intentions and purposes of the British colonial officials, their presence was far-reaching and ultimately revolutionary in its effects. One group of Europeans whose intentions and goals were more sweeping than those of the colonial officials were the Christian missionaries. These missionaries often preceded the colonial officials in Africa, and missionary lobbies in London were in fact an important influence on British government decisions to intervene in Africa, often despite the resistance of treasury and colonial officials who understood the bleak economic prospects there. Missionaries were seeking not only religious conversions in Africa, but also radical changes in the African way of life. Not only the abolition of slavery, but also changed sexual mores, literacy, cleanliness, and numerous other features of Western civilization. British missionaries were at work in the region that was to become Nigeria well before the British government took over that region. Eventually, the number of missionaries in Nigeria ran into the hundreds, the number of churches into the thousands, and the African members of these churches into the hundreds of thousands. Until 1898, all Western education in Nigeria was Christian missionary education, and that remained substantially true as late as 1942, though the rise of an educated class of Nigerians led to growing demands that the colonial government itself do more for education. Because education in Nigeria was essentially Christian, European-centered education, it was not welcome in the Muslim northern region of the country, where more than half the population lived. Missionary education was therefore concentrated in the southern regions, leading to large and lasting disparities in the educational levels of different tribes of Nigerians, with historic consequences for the economic, social, and political future of the country. Even within the southern regions, some groups were more receptive than others. Most receptive were the Igbos, a poorer, more fragmented group, once heavily raided by slave hunters and living in a less fertile part of Nigeria. To the Igbos, Western education was a rare opportunity to be seized. The largest of the Nigerian groups, the Hausa Fulani tribes from the Muslim northern regions, constituted 28% of the population of the country around the middle of the 20th century. The next largest group, about 18% of the population, were the Igbos. The Yorubas from the southwestern region of the country were very similar in size, 17% of the population, but very different in history, economics, and culture, and also had the highest per capita income. There were and are innumerable other groups, living either in their own geographic enclaves or scattered through regions in which other tribes have been dominant. However, the term tribe, while used in Nigeria as elsewhere, is misleading insofar as it suggests isolated bands of people living in the wild. The major tribes of Nigeria each includes millions of people, urban as well as rural, scattered over territories as large as whole nations in Europe. As the Nigerian economy began to be gradually transformed from a subsistence economy to a money economy under the British, exports such as peanuts, palm products, and other agricultural produce increased sharply. After the turn of the century, peanut exports more than tripled over the next 20 years, while palm product exports rose more than fourfold. Cocoa exports by 1939 were more than five times what they were just 20 years earlier. While Nigeria remained a predominantly rural, subsistence agricultural economy, urban centers grew over the years. Most were in the western Yoruba region, where Ibadan had 175,000 inhabitants in 1911, more than 238,000 in 1921, and over 387,000 by 1931. Kano, an ancient commercial city in the Muslim northern region, had about 97,000 people in 1931, while not a single city of the eastern Igbo region had as many as 20,000 people at that time. However, by 1953, there were five eastern cities with more than 40,000 people, four of these cities now being larger than any city in the north except Kano. In part, this reflected the growing prosperity of the Igbos, though many Igbos were enjoying that prosperity in other parts of the country as well. At about the same mid-century mark, per capita income in the western region was twice that in the northern region, with eastern region incomes being in between. Partly these economic differences reflected differences in education in the various regions, as well as the greater initial prosperity of the Yorubas. Education remained rare throughout the colonial history of Nigeria, and very unevenly distributed. Western education in Roman letters was achieved by only 8.5% of all Nigerians as late as 1953, while literacy in Arab script was achieved by 5.4%, concentrated in the Muslim northern regions. Western education, and specifically English language education, was crucial for economic advancement in the government and in the modern industrial and commercial sectors run by the British. Here, the disparities between regions was extreme. As of 1912, for example, there were fewer than 1,000 students in elementary school in northern Nigeria, where more than half the population lived, and more than 35,000 in the rest of the country. By 1926, there were approximately 5,200 primary school students in the north, and more than 138,000 in the other regions. While the growth in Western education continued in all regions, the disparities also continued. By 1957, when there were approximately 185,000 elementary school pupils receiving Western education in the northern regions, there were 2.3 million in the other regions, whose combined populations were not as large. Similar patterns of disparity existed and persisted in secondary education and in higher education. As late as 1937, there were fewer than 100 secondary school students receiving Western education in the northern region and more than 4,200 in the other regions. 20 years later, there were approximately 3,600 secondary school pupils in the north and more than 28,000 elsewhere. In higher education, the disparities were even greater. As late as 1951, out of the 16 million people in the northern region, only one had a full university degree, and he was a convert to Christianity. Meanwhile, virtually all the Nigerian students in institutions of higher education, whether overseas or at home, were southern Nigerians. By the academic year 1959-60, on the eve of independence, northern Nigerians were just 9% of the students at the University of Ibadan. Among the much larger number of Nigerian students studying abroad in foreign institutions of higher learning, only 2% were Hausa Fulani as late as 1966. These vast educational disparities were, of course, reflected in occupational disparities. Out of 160 physicians in Nigeria in the early 1950s, 76 were Yorubas, 49 were Igbos, and only one was Hausa Fulani. In the army, 3/4 of the riflemen were Hausa Fulani, while 4/5 of the officers were Southerners. As late as 1965, 1/2 of the officer corps was specifically Igbo. Even within the northern regional government, southern Nigerians outnumbered northern Nigerians in some occupations requiring medical or technical skills. At lower levels as well, Igbos predominated in clerical and semi-skilled jobs in the postal service, banks, and the railway in northern Nigeria, and were also prominent as traders, artisans, merchants, and factory workers there. As regards the Igbos, at least, none of this reflected any initial advantages over the northerners. Not only were the Igbos a poorer group from a less fertile region of Nigeria, those who migrated to the northern region were treated as outsiders and forced to live in separate residential areas and to send their children to separate schools by order of the local authorities. Fear of the impact of foreign ideas and ways on the traditional Muslim societies of northern Nigeria led to this resistance to Nigerian migrants, just as it produced a ban on Christian missionary work there. The growing classes of educated and semi-educated Nigerians of whatever ethnic origins, though still only a minority of the population, were to play an important role in the country's history. By the early 1920s, there were nearly 30,000 Nigerians engaged in modern elite or sub-elite occupations, mostly clerks, teachers, or artisans, but including also more than 100 clergymen and a dozen or so doctors, lawyers, and civil servants. By the early 1950s, there were 35,000 Nigerian teachers alone, 27,000 clerks, 32,000 artisans, and from 100 to several hundred Nigerian managers, clergy, civil servants, doctors, and lawyers. These newly created elites and sub-elites of Nigeria were historically both the promoters and destroyers of British colonial rule. The newly emerging Nigerians, educated or semi-educated, opposed traditional African values and patterns, which they saw as backward, and thus initially favored the spread of Western influence as a counterweight and as a harbinger of progress. Yet growing resentment of white racism and other negative features of colonialism later led the same class of people to take the lead in seeking independence. This was not all mere inconsistency or opportunism. There had first to be created a nation of Nigeria for there to be an independent nation of Nigeria, and the emerging black westernized elite saw the colonial power as the force needed to weld the many disparate peoples of the region into a viable body politic. The building of a railway by the British, for example, was welcomed by educated Africans as a step in nation building. Ties between the colonial officials and traditional African rulers willing to serve them alienated the emerging educated Africans, who had a very untraditional vision of their country's future. The growth of local political institutions modeled on Western democracy and the development of trade unions, especially during the 1940s, provided both the forum and the training ground for a new, westernized Nigerian political leadership. Eventually, this black leadership pressured and negotiated independence for Nigeria beginning in 1960. As in much of the rest of Africa, independence in Nigeria marked the onset of internal power struggles among the disparate peoples lumped together as a nation artificially created by the colonial power. Even before independence arrived, different tribes and regions had very different reactions to the impending event. Igbos took the lead in advocating independence, urgently soon, with a strong national government. The Yoruba formed their own separate movement for independence, leaving more room for regional autonomy and with more of a role for tribal solidarity. The more fundamental split, however, was between the southern Nigerians as a whole and the northern Nigerians, who saw that immediate independence would mean immediate domination of the north itself by southerners, who already predominated in many branches of both the public and private sectors of the north, and whose far larger educated classes would ensure such domination in the future. Under British indirect rule, the traditional leaders and authorities in the northern region had more control of the region's way of life and its future than they could expect in a southern-dominated, independent Nigeria. The problem was not simply that there were differences of opinion, but that there were no established and mutually respected traditions for airing those differences with restraint and accommodation. Vitriolic polemics in the press and in the political arena became the norm. Epithets like fascist and imperialist stooge became common currency, along with unbridled expressions of tribal chauvinism. A northern political leader said to southerners, "We despise each other." He said, "We call each other ignorant," because one group had Western education and culture, while the other derived its education and culture from the East. He added, "To tell you the plain truth, the common people of the North put more confidence in the white man than in either their black southern brothers or the educated northerners." This was not mere hyperbole, as events later showed. Dates set for Nigerian independence in the 1950s came and went without independence, not because the British would not grant it, but because Nigerians could not agree among themselves as to when and in what constitutional form independence should come. After a date and a constitution were finally agreed to, policies of Nigerianization of government jobs currently held by Europeans were proclaimed. In the northern region, the policy was more specifically northernization, with emphasis on expelling southern Nigerians from these jobs, far more than expelling European expatriates. Even the first census after independence became embroiled in political controversy among tribes and regions, and was nullified amid charges of fraud. Riots, plots, and coups also marked the first decade of independence. In January 1966, Nigerian Prime Minister Balewa was assassinated in the course of a military coup. All these political events had strong ethnic impact in a country where no single group constituted even a third of the population, and where major geographic regions were the domains of different tribes or ethnic groups. That the assassinated prime minister was from the Muslim northern region, and most leaders of the coup were Igbo military officers from the Christian south, proved to be of fateful significance in the way the military government's acts were perceived, resisted, and then openly rebelled against. In June 1966, mobs in northern cities attacked the Igbos living in their midst, killing hundreds of them amid widespread destruction of property. This was only a faint foretaste of the larger tragedy ahead. In July, a counter-coup by Muslim military officers from the north drove the Igbo-dominated regime from power and killed its leader. In September, new and more bloody riots broke out against Igbos in the north. Northern soldiers chased Igbo troops from their barracks and murdered scores with bayonets. Screaming Muslim mobs descended on the Igbo quarters of every northern city, killing their victims with clubs, poison arrows, and shotguns. Tens of thousands of Igbos were murdered in the systematic massacres that followed. In addition to an estimated 30,000 deaths, there were more than 1 million Igbo refugees who fled the region to join their fellow Igbos in the southeast. This in turn led to the fateful decision of the Igbos to withdraw from Nigeria, where they no longer felt safe, and to form their own independent state, which they called Biafra. The civil war set off by the secession of May 1967 raged for more than 2 years. Only four African nations recognized Biafra. Both communist and Western Bloc nations alike backed the government of oil-rich Nigeria, which was well supplied with modern weaponry to use against the rebel forces. Nigerian government troops cut off Biafra from access to the sea, and therefore from food and military supplies. Igbos began starving to death at a rate of 1,000 a day. More than 1 million people died in Biafra from the fighting, starvation, and disease. In addition, 3 million Igbos became refugees. When Biafra surrendered and again became part of Nigeria in 1970, the institutions and economy of the region were devastated, and many feared obliteration of the Igbo culture or even genocide against the Igbo people by the victorious forces. However, in contrast to the mass slaughters in such other African nations as Burundi or Uganda, and in contrast to its own bloody precedents, Nigeria took the path of reconciliation. Industry in the war zone was rehabilitated. So were Igbo political and military personnel, including some officials of the former Biafran government. In 1982, even the exiled leader of Biafra, now a millionaire businessman living in the Ivory Coast, was granted a pardon. Igbos again became a prosperous element in the Nigerian society, holding important positions in both the public and private sectors. Military rule in Nigeria gave way to civilian government and to reorganized political regions designed to break up the ethnic blocs whose conflicts had plunged the country into civil war. Much of the new Nigerian government structure was modeled after that of the United States rather than that of Britain. The turbulent history of post-independence Nigeria has been plagued by four major and interdependent problems. 1. Ethnic or tribal animosities. 2. Desperate political struggles to gain control of the government at all costs. 3. Widespread corruption. And 4. Economic breakdowns. Because no ethnic group trusts another to rule over it, elections and even censuses bring all-out efforts to prevail by any means necessary, including force and fraud. High voter turnout, which some equate with a healthy democracy, has been in Nigeria, and in some other countries, an indication instead of a fever pitch of political polarization. So too have been the drastic differences in voting support for candidates of different ethnic background from one region to another. Even in the 1979 election, held after a new constitution designed to mitigate ethnic politics, each of five presidential candidates received an absolute majority of the votes in at least one state, and less than 5% of the vote in another state or states. Control of the government has been desperately important, not only to avoid being oppressed by rival tribes, but also because the massive role of government in the economy has made politics the preeminent route to prosperity as well as power, whether for individuals, tribes, or regions. As of 1964, governments at the federal, regional, and local levels employed more than half of the wage earners in the country. Government also allocated large sums to the various regions, which is also to say to the various tribes. In 1961, for example, the northern region, containing more than half the population of Nigeria, paid only 9% of the personal income taxes, while it received 45% of the money allocated to the various regions by the federal government. At the same time, the western region paid 64% of all personal income taxes and received less than one-fourth of the funds allocated by the federal government to the various regions. In tribal terms, the Yoruba were subsidizing the House of Fulani and other northern groups. Government employment also paid far more than the private marketplace, as well as providing opportunities for additional income through corruption. A scholar specializing in the study of Nigeria summarized the situation. Legislators, ministers, and high-ranking civil servants could expect to earn from 7 to 30 times the pay of an ordinary government laborer, even without considering their car allowances, housing subsidies, and other emoluments. And such official earnings were trivial relative to what could be amassed through favoritism to private business concerns and diversion of public funds into private accounts. The fortunes to be made through favoritism by government officials were based on the government's role as massive dispenser of largesse and tight controller of economic activities. These included the awarding of loans, contracts, bank credit, positions on public boards and corporations, military commissions, and trade licenses. Moreover, the men whose decisions would determine such things were often from humble backgrounds, if not grinding poverty, and were now not only affluent themselves, but were also able to help family members, but only so long as they stayed in office. To lose office was not to return to something of comparable prestige and earnings in the private sector, but to be devastated, both personally and in career terms. The extraordinary corruption of Nigeria, as well as the ruthless repression of opponents, were products of these circumstances. The utter loss of public confidence in politicians facilitated the military coups of 1966, 1979, and 1983. Investigations after those coups revealed an astonishing scale of corruption among the deposed political leadership, with misappropriations of funds exceeding more than $30 million by just one state governor, enough to pay more than three-quarters of the arrears in salaries of civil servants who had not been paid for months. The corruption of the electoral process was no less dramatic. A Yoruba governor, defeated through vote fraud, was later found by a court to have won, in fact, by 1 million votes. As an oil-exporting nation, Nigeria prospered during the era of high oil prices in the 1970s. Oil provided between 60 and 80% of federal and state government revenues, and the largesse this made possible kept many groups reasonably contented. Both public consumption and private investment grew rapidly during the decade of the 1970s. However, a drop in oil prices on the world market, beginning in the early 1980s, caused drastic economic and social dislocations in Nigeria. By 1986, the value of oil exports was only about one-fifth what it had been just 6 years earlier. In only 3 years, from 1985 to 1988, the value of the Nigerian currency fell to one-fifth its former level. The federal government laid off 50,000 workers, while the state governments and the private sector also had large-scale layoffs. Foreign workers, attracted to Nigeria from other African countries during boom times, were deeply resented during hard times, and were brutally expelled en masse, largely to Ghana. During the worst period of the early 1980s, Nigeria had a declining national output for four consecutive years. However, the new military government imposed austerity, including a reduction in subsidies to the state-owned airlines and public utilities, and began selling state-owned businesses. By 1988, there was a rising national output, in real terms, even allowing for inflation. This growth in real output continued on into the 1990s, while the runaway inflation was reduced to just under 29% per year. Attempts were made to depoliticize the country's ethnic groups and foster democratic government. In 1979, a northern Muslim was elected president, with an Igbo as his running mate. He was re-elected in 1982, and then deposed by another military coup at the end of 1983. This new military regime was long-lived. As of 1997, it was still promising elections in 1998, though it permitted only a few political parties to form, not including those with serious possibilities of winning. The many difficulties encountered during Nigeria's first generation after independence were not altogether surprising, much less unique, and were certainly not worse than what happened in ancient Britain after the Romans withdrew. Nigeria has remained one nation, despite threatened secessions of the northern region and an actual attempt at secession by the eastern region. Clearly, Nigeria learned some lessons from its economic, social, and political problems, and attempted to apply those lessons in new constitutions and new policies. The more fundamental problem for Nigeria and other countries is whether one nation can copy the institutions of another nation and culture without the historical evolution of traditions that made those institutions viable. Standards of honesty are particularly difficult to synthesize. A 1997 international survey ranked Nigeria the most corrupt nation in the world. Tanzania. Tanzania, on the tropical east coast of Africa, is about three times the size of Italy but has only about half as many people. The population per square mile in Tanzania is very similar to that of the United States. The country is composed of two formerly separate political entities, located respectively on the continental mainland, Tanganyika, and on the offshore island of Zanzibar. The country's name derives from the combination of these two names. Geographically, Tanzania's most famous feature is Mount Kilimanjaro. It also shares Lake Victoria with Uganda to the north, and in the south, it shares Lake Tanganyika with Mali and Mozambique. Both bodies of water are among the 10 largest lakes in the world, Lake Victoria being larger than Lake Michigan and Lake Tanganyika being larger than Lake Erie. Like much of Africa, Tanzania suffers from low and unpredictable rainfall, with only about half the country receiving 30 or more inches of rain annually. The region has been plagued historically by recurring droughts, has poor soil and few permanent rivers, as distinguished from shallow streams that appear and disappear according to seasonal rainfall. The tsetse fly infests more than half the mainland, making cattle and draft animals impracticable in the infected regions. Soil and topography vary greatly, with population density varying correspondingly, concentrating in those regions with relatively fertile land and sufficient rainfall. More than 90% of the population remained rural in the late 20th century, and Tanzania remained one of the poorest countries on the world's poorest continent. In 1995, the World Bank ranked Tanzania 172nd in income among 174 nations. The region of East Africa, now known as Tanzania, has long had populations highly fragmented into tribal groups. Post-independence Tanzania remained fragmented into more than 100 ethnic groups, no one of whom exceeded 13% of the population, and the five largest of whom, put together, added up to only about one-fourth of the country's population. Relations among its ethnic groups have not been as central a problem in Tanzania as in Nigeria, though some tribes took advantage of educational opportunities more so than others, and have been correspondingly better represented in higher-level occupations, with corresponding resentments by others. The various tribes speak different languages, and historically, some tribes enslaved others. In the centuries before European colonization, the coastal regions of East Africa had little contact with interior regions of the continent, as compared to its contact with the island of Zanzibar, or even with Persian Gulf peoples. This reflected the vast differences in cost between transport over water and transport over land. There was trade inland, but it was short-distance trade. The economic ties of coastal East Africa were largely with the Arab countries, or with Zanzibar, which was also controlled by Arabs. From the flourishing trade center of Zanzibar, whose leading trade items were ivory and African slaves, the Arabs began to conquer parts of coastal East Africa. Their principal targets were trading settlements, such as Kilwa, which they took in 1784, the island of Pemba, 1822, and the port of Mombasa, captured in 1837. Among the peoples of Zanzibar, in addition to the African population and Arab overlords, there were numerous commercial people from India, as well as foreign traders from Germany, Britain, and the United States. In commerce, however, the Indians were preeminent, and by 1861, they controlled three-quarters of the immovable property on the island. As early as the 18th century, Indians also dominated the river trade on the mainland. Foreign influences on coastal East Africa included European imperialism, as well as the imperialism of the Arabs and the commercial dominance of the Indians. As far back as the late 15th century, the Portuguese visited the region. Less than a decade later, the Portuguese sacked the cities of Mombasa and Kilwa, and shortly thereafter claimed control of the coastal region. This control was neither complete nor unchallenged, however. After nearly two centuries, punctuated by the rebellions, invasions, and intrigues of various factions, the Portuguese were eventually forced out by the Arabs. There was, of course, no nation of Tanganyika or Tanzania at this point. But political units in the region were growing larger and including more heterogeneous populations, though not to as great a degree as in West Africa. The interior tribes of East Africa, like isolated cultures elsewhere in the world, tended to lag behind the development of more cosmopolitan areas, such as the coastal regions. Still, such outside artifacts as firearms eventually reached the interior, changing both the hunting of animals and power relationships among the tribes. Firearms meant a more widespread hunting of elephants and a need for smaller tribes to seek protection in alliances with chiefs of larger tribes that had guns. The net result was a growth of tribal empires in the era preceding European conquest of the area. Germany seized Tanganyika in the 1880s, but fierce and bloody resistance continued on into the early years of the 20th century. In the last of these rebellions, 26,000 Africans were killed, according to official German figures, which do not include those who died of hunger and disease resulting from the devastations and disruptions of all-out warfare. German rule in Tanganyika lasted until World War I, when a British naval blockade and military invasion brought control of the colony to the United Kingdom. The economic and cultural impact of Germans on Tanganyika was considerable, despite the relatively short historical era of their rule, which was only about one generation. Dar es Salaam, the principal port and later capital, developed into an important town under the Germans. Germans introduced new capital, new crops, and modern transportation. They also brutally oppressed the Africans with taxes and forced labor, quite aside from the carnage of warfare resulting from resistance to their rule. Perhaps the most enduring cultural legacy of German rule was the rendering of Swahili into Latin letters by Germans and their spreading of this language as a unifying lingua franca through the polyglot regions of East Africa. Colonialism also promoted disunity, however, by dividing the Maasai tribe, for example, between British and German colonies in East Africa. Germans also penetrated the island of Zanzibar, though not as military conquerors and not as pervasively as the Indians did. There were German traders established in Zanzibar as early as the middle of the 19th century, and by 1870, Germans conducted almost one-third of the commerce on the island. The Arabs remained the official rulers, though less and less so in substance as the British extended their influence and eventually control. In 1890, an agreement between Britain and Germany recognized a British protectorate over Zanzibar. German and British colonial rule was also a major factor in the Indians' contribution to the economic development of Zanzibar and the East African mainland. Indians came in greater numbers, penetrated deeper into continental Africa, and settled more permanently under colonial rule and protection. Indians became the dominant commercial people throughout East Africa in general. The British, as the colonial rulers of India, often brought Indians to their African territories, but the Germans also encouraged Indians to immigrate to Tanganyika during their rule there. One of the major forms of trade in Tanganyika and Zanzibar was the trade in human beings, slaves. Missionary explorer David Livingstone reported in the early 1860s that 19,000 slaves from Nyasaland were sent to Zanzibar alone. As elsewhere in East Africa, the Arabs were the leading slave traders. The British struggle against the slave trade continued for generations, encountering both African and Arab opposition. The task of ending the very institution of slavery itself was especially formidable in Arab-dominated regions, such as Zanzibar. It was not until 1922 that slavery was finally stamped out in Tanganyika, after the British were firmly in control. When the Germans were expelled after World War I, Indians acquired most of the real estate in Dar es Salaam. For the country as a whole, Indians held an estimated 50-60% of the import-export trade, 80% of sisal production, 80% of transport service, and 90% of all town property, as well as hundreds of small general stores, mostly in rural areas. The majority were Gujarati Indians, an important commercial group in India itself. The way of life of the interior tribes on the East African mainland was especially disrupted. While they benefited from agricultural innovations, many local crafts succumbed to cheaper or better mass-produced goods from India, and most of the cattle in most parts of the country were wiped out by the disease Rinderpest, which particularly weakened the cattle-herding Maasai. The devastations of African populations caused by colonial warfare created vacant areas where thick bush grew unchecked, creating conditions for more wild game and more tsetse flies, which now infested an even larger area than before. Colonial demands for porters, in an era with a dearth of water or animal transport, were enormous and oppressive in East Africa, as they were in other parts of the continent, whether under British, French, or German rule. The Germans conscripted tens of thousands of porters in East Africa, and the British 200,000. Death rates were high among the porters, sometimes as high as 20 to 25%. Economic growth in export products was substantial and sustained under both German and British colonial rule. Exports from Tanganyika increased more than tenfold between 1883 and 1913. Between 1913, under German rule, and 1938, under British rule, the value of exports from the colony of Tanganyika more than doubled. Sisal exports increased nearly fivefold, coffee more than tenfold, and peanuts became an important export. These were by no means all a result of European-owned or European-directed enterprise. As of 1933, more than half the coffee produced in the country was grown by Africans, who owned a total of 6 million coffee bushes. Cotton production in Tanganyika was carried out almost exclusively by small African farmers living in the vicinity of Lake Victoria. Although Africans were showing themselves capable of taking initiative and responsibility in producing for the market, two world events, the Great Depression and the Second World War, promoted more use of force by the colonial authorities. As world prices fell during the Great Depression, the poll tax imposed on Africans remained the same in money terms, which is to say, it increased in real terms. To ensure the payment of this tax, the colonial official pressured African farmers into growing larger export crops, even at the expense of food. Thus, Africans had to depend on government famine relief when local food crops were disappointing. Further government control was promoted by World War II, and especially by the world shortage of rubber, after the loss of British and American rubber-producing areas in Asia to the Japanese. To produce crops deemed strategic in the war effort, and to feed the workers growing these crops, the colonial government took an active role in the economy. Among other things, this meant a greatly increased conscription of African labor, from less than 1,000 workers in 1941 to more than 30,000 by 1944. This exercise in government planning became a precedent for more such experiments in the post-war years. Again, the Africans were given little or no choice, as a succession of agricultural plans came down from the government, and often failed in practice. Over the years, along with economic and social benefits, the colonial government created many grievances. As elsewhere, it also created a new westernized class among the indigenous population, a group of educated and semi-educated people with a vision of the future for their country that was unlike either the traditional past or the colonial present. Not incidentally, it was to be a future in which these westernized elite would rise to the top. The campaign for independence in Tanganyika was led by a Western-educated former schoolteacher, Julius K. Nyerere. Nyerere's Tanganyika African National Union, TANU, mobilized discontent and ambition, first among the westernized, educated, and semi-educated Africans. Despite the colonial government's resistance and repression, TANU achieved its principal goal. Tanganyika became independent in 1961. Its union with Zanzibar 3 years later created the new nation of Tanzania. Tanzania still bears the cultural imprint of colonial rule. Swahili, its official language, was spread under German auspices, and its capital city, Dar es Salaam, was built by Arabs and has an Arabic name. As president of Tanzania, Julius Nyerere became known internationally for his lofty goals and humanitarian statements that caused him to be called the conscience of Africa. At home, he tried to impose his vision of an egalitarian, socialist society by authoritarian methods. By government edict, a majority of Tanzania's population was grouped into villages, whether they wanted to be or not. As with so many other communal agricultural schemes in various nations and eras, those in Tanzania led to peoples doing as little work as possible on the communal crop and as much as possible on their own individual plots. Tanzania's output per worker declined over a period of a decade, and the country went from being an exporter of maize to being an importer. Hundreds of nationalized firms went bankrupt. The railroad from Tanzania to Zambia broke down so often that the Africans who ran it were replaced by Chinese at virtually all levels. Once prosperous Zanzibar suffered the economic decline of the rest of Tanzania and was often without electricity. All this occurred in a country that received more foreign aid per capita than any other, and which had large unpaid loans extended for years at zero interest. On the political front, Nyerere jailed thousands of political prisoners, more than South Africa at one point in the 1970s, and many were tortured, according to Amnesty International. Nyerere was repeatedly unopposed in elections, which he won by majorities attained elsewhere only in communist countries. He also helped overthrow three other African governments, including the Amin regime in Uganda, which Nyerere replaced with his own puppet rulers, the latter being replaced in turn and jailed by Nyerere when the Tanzanian leader disapproved of their performance. Yet his unassuming lifestyle and personality, and his idealistic statements, made him an enormous favorite of Western intellectuals. What the 17 million Tanzanians thought of Nyerere could not be known, for Tanzania was a one-party state with a government-controlled press, and a society honeycombed with party cells that made the free expression of opinion dangerous. The economic debacle in Tanzania reached virtually every kind of activity, agricultural or industrial, domestic or foreign. Cotton production, which was 79,000 tons in the mid-1960s, fell to about 50,000 tons by the early 1980s. Over a period of a decade, cashew production fell by more than 50% and sisal production by nearly 60%. The industrial sector, by the 1980s, was operating at from 10 to 30% of capacity. The total output of the country was declining, and inflation averaged 35% per year. Perhaps most decisive of all, the Nyerere regime in Tanzania finally began to lose its credibility with international lending and donor organizations, which had subsidized its policies in the past. From 1980 to 1985, per capita real income in Tanzania fell by 12%. The resignation of Julius Nyerere as president of Tanzania in late 1985 and the inauguration of Ali Hassan Mwinyi as the new president marked a policy change as well as a change of personalities. A modest degree of relaxation of government control in the economy began to produce signs of economic recovery, including the first rise in per capita real income in nearly a decade. These changing policies also produced internal dissension within the ruling party, still headed by Nyerere after relinquishing the presidency. However, by 1990, Tanzania had achieved four consecutive years of growth in real national output and enacted a new constitution permitting multi-party elections. Clearly, some of the lessons of the mistakes of the immediate post-independence era had been learned, and at least the beginnings of important changes made. In 1995, Ali Hassan Mwinyi was succeeded as president by Benjamin Mkapa, whose cabinet has been characterized as distinguished by youth, competence, and the absence of old faces. Many of Tanzania's old problems remained, however, including pervasive corruption that extends even into the courtrooms. Lawyers have been quoted in the Tanzanian press as saying that any judgment can be bought, and that an attorney does not need a knowledge of law books in court if his pockets are full. Well-known public figures have been assassinated, apparently by professional killers. President Mkapa ran on an anti-corruption platform in 1995, and an anti-corruption commission report led to the resignation of the Minister of Tourism. Yet how far such a deep-seated practice as official corruption, common in Africa, can be brought under control is problematical. Nevertheless, the new economic policies continued to produce economic growth in real per capita terms in the 1990s. Despite the worst drought in 40 years, in a country where most of the output is agricultural, the total value of that output continued to rise in 1995. In this case, at least, the devastations of nature have not had nearly the bad effects that the devastations of man produced in the first decades after independence. Ghana. The West African nation of Ghana is slightly smaller in size than Great Britain or the American state of Oregon. The population of Ghana, however, is less than one-third that of Britain, and the literacy rate in Ghana was only 30% in 1980, rising to 60% by 1990. Known as the Gold Coast during more than a century of British colonial rule, Ghana reverted to its traditional name when it became an independent nation in 1957. Geographically, nature provided no harbors in which ships could anchor and unload, sheltered from the heavy surf in that region of West Africa. As elsewhere, large vessels had to anchor offshore and be unloaded piecemeal into canoes and small boats, obviously adding to shipping costs and delays in transit, and generally impeding economic progress by limiting what goods had sufficient value to repay such additional transport costs. River traffic was also severely limited in distance by numerous rapids, and in volume by the shallowness of the water, which restricted the size of boats. In view of this, it is hardly surprising that most of the major towns developed along the coast, from trading centers that were more easily accessible by coastwise boats than in the interior. Ghana has been well endowed with natural resources, but not with the natural means of transporting them or of tying its peoples together culturally or politically, and connecting them with larger cultural developments elsewhere. Culturally, Ghana's people are fragmented into about 100 ethnic or linguistic groups, many numbering less than 10,000 persons, and none constituting more than 15% of the total population. They are also divided religiously among Christians, Muslims, and followers of various indigenous African religions. As in other parts of Africa, there was a history of stronger tribes in the region conquering weaker tribes or conducting raids against them to obtain slaves. The Ashanti tribe was the leading conquering and enslaving force. The Ashanti, based in the western uplands of the region, began to dominate surrounding tribes as early as the 17th century, and continued their military expansion on into the second half of the 19th century when they came into armed collision with the British. Like the British in a later era, the Ashanti conquerors followed a policy of indirect rule in a growing Ashanti confederation. Meanwhile, isolated European trading settlements were being established along the coast, attracted principally by the trade in gold that gave the region its name. The Portuguese arrived as early as 1471 and built their first fort in 1482. However, during the 17th and 18th centuries, the Dutch, British, Danes, and Swedes also established coastal trading settlements and also found it necessary to fortify them militarily. Soon, the Europeans were fighting among themselves along the coast, while Africans fought among themselves inland. In the Gold Coast, as in other parts of the world, the British government was reluctant to take on the costs of a colonial venture that could easily be more trouble than it was worth. Where private groups of Britons wanted to try it, as in the Gold Coast, the government would authorize, sanction, and to a limited extent oversee the operation, while the private company supplied the money, the manpower, and even the fighting forces. As elsewhere, however, these kinds of low-budget imperialism acquired a life of their own in Africa. The very disunity among indigenous peoples that made them vulnerable to such incursions also threatened the stability of any modus vivendi worked out by the British with local authorities, in a fluid situation complicated by contending tribes, sporadic military incidents, and major outbreaks of tribal warfare. Eventually, as elsewhere, the British government found itself drawn into these wars, especially when the Ashanti began making attacks on coastal tribes with whom the British had agreements and alliances. Moreover, the British ban on the slave trade in 1808 had serious and negative economic consequences on the economy of the Gold Coast, and brought the British more and more into conflict with Africans whose economies depended on the slave trade. Eventually, in the Gold Coast as elsewhere, the British government took over the colonies from private groups. The Ashanti invaded the coastal regions repeatedly in the early 19th century, disrupting trade and forcing the local European outposts to recognize Ashanti claims in these regions. The British government took control in 1821, and in 1826 defeated a new Ashanti invasion with the help of African coastal tribes. A new treaty in 1831 saw the beginning of a long period of peace and expanding trade in the area. The last Ashanti invasion took place in 1873. A force of fewer than 3,000 British troops, supported by African auxiliaries, defeated the Ashanti, invaded their homelands, and burned their capital. Though the Ashanti were great warriors, that alone was not enough to prevail against modern weapons. Later uprisings by the Ashanti led the British to annex their whole territory. Over a period of generations, the Gold Coast thus became a British colony, in bits and pieces, with varying degrees of direct and indirect rule. By the early 20th century, the British had consolidated the colony and their own position in it. Under British rule, progress was made against some of the Gold Coast's many debilitating and deadly tropical diseases, and the country's exports increased greatly. Deaths from malaria were substantially reduced, and yellow fever was almost completely eliminated. Among animal diseases, rinderpest was brought under control. In the economy, the total value of exports from the Gold Coast or Ghana increased more than fourfold from 1907 to 1928, and almost tenfold from 1928 to 1959. Cocoa, introduced in 1879, became the prime export product, constituting a substantial fraction of the country's total output and accounting for a substantial fraction of its employment and often a majority of its export earnings. The Gold Coast became, and remained, the world's leading producer of cocoa. Gold and manganese production, and exports and imports in general, were largely in British hands, while local commerce was in the hands of Lebanese and Indian businessmen. Cocoa production, however, was in the hands of Africans. The British built railroads, beginning in 1898, connecting some of the commercial centers with each other, and developed modern transportation and communications links with the outside world. The country's main seaport is a man-made harbor built under the British and opened in 1928. Among the human infrastructure developed under the British was a small but growing educated class, products of missionary schools established in the 19th century. As far back as 1881, missionaries set up more than 100 schools in the Gold Coast, teaching about 5,000 students. Christian missionaries became an important influence in the Gold Coast, beginning in the coastal areas and then spreading through the southern part of the country. Penetration of the northern areas was more difficult because of transportation problems and because of the existing presence of Islam there. Thus, as the missionaries established churches, schools, hospitals, and clinics, the impact of these Western influences varied regionally, accentuating cultural differences among the tribes of the Gold Coast. Another factor accentuating internal differences among the African population was the colonial government's need for clerks and other subordinates, recruited locally, but to some extent westernized by their new roles. As elsewhere, it was precisely this westernized minority, a product of European church and state, that provided the impetus for the movement toward independence. As elsewhere, the leaders who came to the fore in the decolonization era were those best able to mobilize politically the grievances and resentments of the populace, and it was such leadership that then took on the very different task of creating a viable country and of meeting the high expectations which they had built up. As in much of Africa, the emerging indigenous elites were heavily concentrated in clerical and school-teaching occupations and disproportionately government-employed. By the 1940s, there were more than 3,000 African civil servants and more than 3,000 African teachers in the Gold Coast, but fewer than 1,500 merchants and fewer than 1,400 cocoa dealers, even though cocoa was the country's leading product. However, there was also a significant private economy contribution to the new westernized African elite in Ghana, largely through the effect of cocoa. This crop was introduced into the Gold Coast by Africans and remained largely an African product produced by numerous small indigenous peasants. As of the 1920s, the Gold Coast members of the National Congress of British West Africa, an independence movement, included a substantial representation of merchants, even though lawyers predominated, in contrast with their much smaller role in other African countries. But spearheading the drive for independence was a man much more typical of the African leadership of that era, Kwame Nkrumah, a Western-educated political activist who had no substantial background in anything else. His special appeal was to the young and the semi-educated, and his political style has been characterized as ritualistic or mystical in an ideological or cult of personality sense. His imprisonment for sedition under the colonial government gave him an added appeal to his constituency. As a result of the electoral success of his party in the 1951 elections, Nkrumah was invited from prison to head up the government that would lead Ghana into independence. Kwame Nkrumah had sweeping ideological goals, sweeping not only within Ghana, but also a sweeping Pan-Africanism with which he hoped to form a transnational Black African unified superstate. Under Nkrumah, power was centralized in the national government as against regional and local bodies. It was centralized in the executive, which subordinated the legislative and judicial branches. Ultimately, power was concentrated in Nkrumah himself, who banned opposition parties, had political adversaries imprisoned without charges for years under preventive detention, and replaced the professional elite in the civil and military services with his own hand-picked men. Beginning its independence with more human and natural resources than most other Black African nations, a higher per capita income, and large foreign reserves, Ghana experienced an almost immediate economic decline in the post-colonial era. By 1965, Ghana's foreign reserves of nearly $500 million in 1958 had turned into a foreign debt of $1 billion. Nkrumah's economic policies were ambitious, if not effective. He built many prestige projects, including a $16 million hall for one meeting of the Organization of African Unity, and a national airline, even though 15 international carriers were flying into Ghana. In 1966, while Nkrumah was en route to China, a military coup ended his regime in Ghana. He went into exile in Guinea, whose president, Sékou Touré, gave him the honorific title co-president. The new government in Ghana had its own problems and excesses. Scores of Mercedes automobiles were flown in for the new rulers, at a cost of more than $100,000 each, plus shipping. Half the foreign exchange received by the government's cocoa marketing agency was unaccounted for. The country's leading export, cocoa, suffered from government controls. The tonnage of cocoa beans and cocoa butter exported both declined sharply between 1966 and 1969, the former by 40% in just 3 years, and the latter by more than half over the same period. Exports of manganese and bauxite also fell. Stores became bare. Transportation broke down. Ghanaians began fleeing to the Ivory Coast and Liberia. From an economy that had been growing during the 1950s, there was now a slight reduction in real output per person for the decade of the 1960s and a steeper reduction of 2.65% per annum between 1970 and 1982. Over this latter period, Ghana's foreign debt rose from less than one-fourth of its annual output to more than a third more than its total output. A second coup in 1978, led by a young Air Force lieutenant named Jerry Rawlings, replaced the existing military government and began executing its leaders for corruption, including the former head of state, who was accused of banking $100 million of ill-gotten gains in foreign countries. A year later, Rawlings returned power to civilian hands. But the country's economic woes continued. Its national debt rose, it fell years behind schedule in repaying its loans, and inflation exceeded 100% per annum. Roads and trucks both fell into such disrepair that the cocoa crop could not be moved to the ports to be exported and began piling up in government warehouses. At the end of 1981, Lieutenant Rawlings again seized power, and soldiers began looting the shops in the capital of Accra. Civilians also looted, with police looking on. Rawlings' policies had a strong idealistic and populist flavor, including price controls that, among other things, made it uneconomic to produce cocoa, the country's most important crop. Exchange rates fixed by the government made it uneconomic for foreign industrial firms to continue operating in Ghana, causing drastic cutbacks in employment and earnings. The country's total output declined absolutely at an average rate of 4% per year during the early 1980s, and investment fell by one-third. Ghana's per capita income, which had been more than double that of Nigeria in 1965, was less than half that of Nigeria by 1985. Food shortages developed, the number of doctors declined, as did life expectancy. Rawlings, however, remained popular in Ghana, an economic failure but a political success. In 1983, however, he made a fundamental change in Ghana's economic policies, following recommendations of the World Bank. The government began to free up the market in various ways. It ended most price controls, devalued the currency internationally, and laid off 50,000 civil servants from a bloated bureaucracy that had increased in size nearly tenfold between 1972 and 1982. government-owned businesses were put up for sale. The response of the economy was dramatic. Ghana's economic growth rate from 1983 to 1988 averaged 6% per annum. Once bare store shelves began to fill up with consumer goods, streets began to be clogged with imported cars. Reversing years of government policy of keeping cocoa prices to the farmers artificially low, the government tripled the price paid to the producers. Over the next 5 years, cocoa production rose by 20%, and the smuggling of cocoa to neighboring countries declined. Ghana's economic turnaround was not only a major contrast to its past under Nkrumah and later statist regimes, but was also in sharp contrast to continued economic deterioration in much of sub-Saharan Africa, where per capita output actually declined 5% in 1987. As Ghana's real national output continued to grow into the 1990s under freer economic policies, freer political policies were also allowed. There was a lifting of the ban on political party activity, a new constitution was approved by popular referendum, and military coup leader Jerry Rawlings was elected president in 1996. More generally, there was at least a hope now that Ghana might have a more promising future in the new 21st century looming on the horizon. Ivory Coast. The Republic of the Ivory Coast is a nation of more than 14 million people spread out over an area larger than France. Like many other African nations, the Ivory Coast is a creation of European colonialism, and its national borders divide many ethnic groups whose brothers live in adjoining nations. This external fragmentation is matched by internal fragmentation. There are 60 ethnic groups in the country, no one of which constitutes more than 15% of the population, while more than one-fourth of the population originated outside the Ivory Coast, primarily elsewhere in West Africa. There are numerous indigenous languages, roughly corresponding to the numerous ethnic groups, but French is the official language of what is officially the République de Côte d'Ivoire, as it is the language of education, politics, and the urban economy. This, too, is a legacy of colonialism. European commercial contacts preceded the colonial era by centuries. There was trade in gold, pepper, slaves, and the ivory, which gave the region its name, though the decimation of the elephant population ended the ivory trade in the early 18th century. The first known French contact with the Ivory Coast dates back to the 15th century, and the first French settlements to the 17th century. Isolated missionaries, traders, and explorers, operating under agreements with local African authorities, were quite different from French colonial rule, which began to be imposed in the late 19th century. Like other colonial powers, the French brought both progress and oppression. Schools were built, the economy modernized, fatal epidemic diseases banished by medical science, and the people were often subjected to direct forced labor or to taxation that forced them to work for whites in order to get money, often to the serious detriment of the native crops with which they fed themselves. Conscription for forced labor was more than an economic loss or a disruption of normal life. Thousands died from the rigors of this forced labor. French colonial officials were under pressure to see that the colonies did not become an excessive burden on France's treasury, and some resorted to the use of whippings, hostages, and even executions to extract taxes from the Africans. Force was also used to change the indigenous agricultural system, to introduce cocoa as a cash crop in the Ivory Coast, for example. The Ivory Coast was part of a larger colonial empire called French West Africa, and this in turn was part of France's worldwide imperial domains, which included French Equatorial Africa, Algeria, Indochina, Martinique, and French Guiana. The French conquest of the Ivory Coast, like European conquests in much of the rest of Africa, began in the last two decades of the 19th century. All of French West Africa combined was about nine times the size of France itself, but as late as 1920, its total population was only 12 million people. Much of the Ivory Coast consisted of largely uninhabited forests. Even in the late 20th century, there remained considerable amounts of unused land, as well as other lands allowed to lie fallow for long periods. Like many other parts of Africa, the Ivory Coast has lacked sheltered harbors and navigable rivers. Its jungles extended down to the water's edge. Large ocean-going vessels could not find suitable places to anchor on the coast, and even small craft found the rivers dangerous or impassable, except for modest stretches that were navigable. Large seasonal rainfall variations still complicate river travel, with rivers going from dry beds to swollen torrents at different times of the year. In the modern era, railroads and canals have provided more dependable travel and shipping conditions, and harbors have been improved. Before the Europeans came, the people of the region lived in small tribal groups, and their main contact with the outside world was through long-distance traders. Geographical handicaps, in addition to a dearth of navigable waterways, included dense jungle covering the southern half of the country. One of the few outside influences was that of the Islamic world, whose traders and conquerors spread the Muslim religion into the northern regions of the country. This, too, left an enduring legacy. In the late 20th century, the religion of one-fourth of the population of the country was Islam, making Muslims twice as numerous as Christians, with most of the remainder being followers of native religions, often with Muslim or Christian admixtures. The post-independence history of the Ivory Coast diverged considerably from that of other African nations during its first two decades. But this divergence was the deliberate choice of one leader, and was, in that sense, very much like the authoritarianism common elsewhere in post-independence Africa. Félix Houphouët-Boigny was an early political leader in French West Africa, with a movement centered in the Ivory Coast and articulating the grievances of his fellow Africans against French colonial policies. Even so, he was seeking amelioration under colonial rule, not independence. Houphouët-Boigny was the French-educated son of an African chief. Born in 1905, he became a physician, a wealthy planter, and a public health official before entering politics in 1944. He spent a dozen years in France, beginning in 1946, first as the Ivory Coast's representative in Parliament, and then as the first African to hold a cabinet position in a European government. The cultural assimilation and acceptance of the small group of educated Africans as black Frenchmen operated to mute anti-colonialism and to co-opt its potential indigenous leaders. But the fall of France in World War II and the rise of a Nazi puppet government in Vichy undermined the legitimacy of French rule, while the racist and exploitative policies the Vichy government followed in the African colonies under Nazi auspices provoked resistance and sabotage. The African solidarity this promoted was one of the ingredients in the post-war movement toward independence. After the war, Houphouët-Boigny won great popularity in 1946 for his role in bringing to an end the hated system of forced labor. New civil and political rights followed piecemeal over the years. In 1960, the Ivory Coast became an independent republic within the international French community, with Houphouët-Boigny as its first president. The post-independence policies of the Ivory Coast differed sharply from those of most other African nations in a number of ways. It avoided executions or coups, and long resisted the widespread policy of building showcase industries that could not pay for themselves. It also imposed few restrictions on the transfer of foreign capital or profits, and did not succumb to the political temptation to drive out foreigners in order to turn their jobs over to Africans. There were more Frenchmen in the Ivory Coast in the 1980s than there were at the time of independence 20 years earlier, and they filled many important positions in government and the economy. This produced resentments among newly educated Africans seeking careers and urging political Africanization. The Ivory Coast also made use of technical experts from Taiwan and improved seeds from Brazil, India, and the Philippines. During the 1980s, the World Bank estimated that foreigners held four-fifths of all jobs in the Ivory Coast requiring a college degree. As of the time of independence, the Ivory Coast was one of the poorest nations in Africa and in the world. However, despite an initially low level of economic development, poor soils, and few natural resource advantages, the Ivory Coast became one of the few African nations whose economy grew faster after independence than under imperialist rule. The Ivory Coast achieved one of the highest sustained growth rates of any black African nation without major petroleum deposits, and in fact, one of the highest growth rates in the world. As of the time of independence in 1960, Real per capita income in the Ivory Coast was slightly less than in neighboring Ghana, but its per capita income grew at more than 4% per year for the decade of the 1960s, compared to less than 2% for the decade of the 1950s under French rule. By 1982, real income per capita in the Ivory Coast was 50% higher than it was in 1960 and was now also 65% greater than in Ghana. The Ivory Coast also remained one of the few countries in Africa that could feed itself. These policies produced a prosperous peasantry and frustrated westernized intellectuals, in contrast to the reverse in other African states. In the first quarter of a century after independence, agricultural output in the Ivory Coast doubled, and private consumption, exports, and gross domestic product all increased 3- or 4-fold. While the initially very small manufacturing sector increased 5-fold. In little more than a quarter of a century, the country's per capita income rose 10-fold, becoming the highest in any black African nation without petroleum deposits. Among the consequences of these policies was that the Ivory Coast often had balanced budgets and avoided international balance of payments problems that plagued other third world countries. Although the Ivory Coast had its economic and social problems, including corruption, these did not compare with the chaos, starvation, or mass killings in some other African nations. But its relative success brought neither the country nor its president the kind of attention or acclaim lavished on others, such as Tanzania's Nyerere or Ghana's Nkrumah. Ufotbonyi embraced few of the fashionable ideas, from Pan-Africanism to socialism. He was also one of the very few African leaders ever to have run a business enterprise. Other political office holders in Black Africa, whether at the top or elsewhere in the political and bureaucratic pyramid, tended to come disproportionately from a white-collar or professional background, including school teaching. Former clerks alone accounted for 1/5 or more of the members of the legislatures of Ghana, Senegal, Guinea, and Tanzania. 2/5 or more of the legislatures of Niger, Mali, and Upper Volta, and 4/5 in the former Belgian Congo. In the Ivory Coast as well, at the time of independence in 1960, the previous skills of about 40% of the members of the National Assembly and the Cabinet were either clerical or educational, and 2/3 had worked for the government. But because of the great role of the head of state in African nations, the fact that the president had a different background apparently accounted for the very different policy approach of the Ivory Coast, and for the very different economic, social, and political consequences. Ufotbonyi's policies not only contrasted with those of Nkrumah in Ghana, the two leaders made a famous bet as to which approach would prove to be more successful. Although Ghana was the more prosperous country at the time and was more richly endowed with natural resources, the subsequent reversal of their respective economic standings was a dramatic demonstration of the effects of the two approaches. Even as regards the social position of the poor, one of the prime talking points of Ghana's more left-wing policies, the Ivory Coast's policies bore fruit. Although income was less equally distributed in the Ivory Coast than in Ghana, people in the bottom 20% of the income distribution in the Ivory Coast had twice the real income of people in the bottom 20% in Ghana. Indeed, the bottom 20% in the Ivory Coast averaged higher real incomes than a majority of the population of Ghana. Partly this was because real income was rising in the Ivory Coast and falling absolutely in Ghana. Also, it must be noted that even the top 20% in the Ivory Coast, the rich by African standards, were making quite modest incomes by the standards of Western Europe or the United States. That this impressive record was due to the policies the country followed, rather than to natural resources or other advantages, was painfully demonstrated in the late 1970s and in the 1980s, after the Ivory Coast succumbed to the political temptations which had so badly affected the economies of other African nations. Instead of continuing its policies of concentrating government expenditures on creating infrastructure and letting the private marketplace produce goods and services, the country's new policies, beginning in the late 1970s, shifted government investment into manufacturing and other state-owned enterprises. Favorable prices for the Ivory Coast's largely agricultural exports brought in the money required to finance such ventures. Moreover, the country's good economic reputation internationally enabled it to borrow abroad. However, such transient good fortune provided no basis for an enduring policy, When the prices of such exports as coffee and cocoa fell in 1978 and the oil shock world recession struck in 1980, a whole era in the economic history of the Ivory Coast came to an end. Between 1975 and 1980, the country's external debt rose by 400%. By 1990, the cost of servicing its international debts absorbed 39% of its export earnings, compared to just 7% 20 years earlier. Even during its earlier good years, when observers spoke of the Ivory Coast's economic miracle, it was not a completely free market economy. Even then, its ventures into the kinds of state regulation engaged in more widely by other African nations had not had good results. For example, the availability of soft foreign aid loans for centralized government planning of rice production led the Ivory Coast into policies that produced a glut of heavily subsidized rice that taxed the storage capacity of the government, cost the national budget far more than originally planned, and led to consumer prices far above those at which rice was available on the world market. Beginning in the early 1980s, the country's national income declined absolutely, while population continued to grow. The long period of one-party and one-man rule likewise ultimately began to take its toll on the Ivory Coast in corruption, in economic problems, and in political repression. In 1992, the capital city of Abidjan had its worst riots since independence, with political opposition leaders being imprisoned. After the death of Houphouet Boigny in December 1993, he was succeeded constitutionally, on an interim basis, by former National Assembly leader Henri Konan Bedi. Bedi's chief rival for the presidency, Prime Minister Alassane Dramane Ouattara, resigned upon Bedi's accession to the presidency. This and a long period of national mourning, during which political activity was muted, contributed to a smooth transition. Privatization, begun in the last years of Houphouet Boigny, continued under the new regime, and this helped turn the economy around. After years of declining national output, the Ivory Coast's real gross domestic product began to grow again, first by a modest 1.8% in 1994, and then by a robust 7% the following year. After serving as interim president for nearly 2 years, Bedié was elected in his own right in October 1995, with an overwhelming victory at the polls. However, this presidential victory, winning 96% of the vote, was tarnished by the fact that two opposition leaders were barred from running and opposition rallies were forbidden. Moreover, despite favorable economic and political trends, the new president began jailing journalists for even mildly critical writings. Earlier, in May 1995, Bedié's government arrested 11 army officers on suspicion of plotting a military coup, though no specifics were made public. Amnesty International has charged the Ivory Coast with jailing more than 200 people for their political opposition. By and large, where the Ivory Coast followed its own pragmatic policies in the first decades after independence, it was successful, both economically and politically, at least in the sense of avoiding the traumatic problems of other tropical African nations. But where it followed policies more like those of other African countries, it suffered many of the same consequences. The African diaspora. There have been relatively few African immigrants to other continents, compared to the vast millions transported as slaves to the Islamic countries or to the Western Hemisphere. The story of the African diaspora is thus largely the story of those slaves and their descendants. By the middle of the 20th century, however, there were also small but historically important groups of African expatriates in Europe and America who returned to Africa to assume leadership of the struggle for independence and then leadership of the newly independent African states. Even aside from African emigrants and expatriates, however, the African diaspora is not coextensive with all African slaves and their descendants. The numbers of people enslaved within Africa itself exceeded the numbers exported. History has largely forgotten them. The Islamic countries. Although the Islamic countries of the Middle East and North Africa imported more slaves from sub-Saharan Africa than did the European offshoot nations of the Western Hemisphere, there are in these Muslim countries today no such large, discrete, and self-conscious groups of black African descent as the 60 million Negroes currently living in the Western Hemisphere. Among the reasons for this anomaly were the higher mortality rates of slaves in transit to North Africa and the Middle East, their greater vulnerability to the diseases of that region, and a very low rate of reproduction. Because the slaves were brought from long distances, often from isolated villages, they might lack biological resistance to the diseases encountered along the overland slave trade routes or at their final destinations. Although manumission was widespread in Islamic lands, the beneficiaries of this were often military slaves and others in higher occupations, where the slaves were most apt to be white rather than black. In general, black slaves were used in more menial and laborious tasks, and it was these slaves who were most likely to live and die as slaves, with their children being born into slavery. They had few children, however, for both marriage and casual sex among slaves was suppressed. Moreover, the death rate among those few children was so high that they rarely lived to adulthood. The widespread use of eunuchs in the harems of the Islamic countries further reduced the ability of the African slave population to reproduce itself. In the 10th century, the court of the Caliph of Baghdad reportedly included 7,000 black eunuchs and 4,000 white eunuchs. With the passing centuries, as European nations grew militarily stronger and became better able to resist the Islamic nations, European slaves became scarcer in the Islamic lands to which they had once been sent in great numbers. Their importation was drastically reduced in the early decades of the 19th century, when Tsarist Russia conquered the Caucasus, from which European slaves were being shipped to the Ottoman Empire. However, as late as the 1850s, orders against the traffic in white slaves from Russian-controlled Georgia and Circassia were being issued by the Ottoman government. By the end of the 19th century, white slaves had virtually disappeared, except in Arabia, while black slavery was not abolished in most Islamic countries until the period between the two world wars of the 20th century, and still existed in Mauritania and the Sudan at the end of the 20th century. The horrors of the Atlantic voyage in packed and suffocating slave ships, together with exposure to new diseases from Europeans and other African tribes, as well as the general dangers of the Atlantic crossing in that era, took a toll in lives amounting to about 10% of all slaves shipped to the Western Hemisphere in British vessels in the 18th century, the British being the leading slave traders of that era. However, the death toll among slaves imported by the Islamic countries, many of these slaves being forced to walk across the vast burning sands of the Sahara, was twice as high. Thousands of human skeletons were strewn along one Saharan slave route alone, mostly the skeletons of young women and girls. These skeletons tended to cluster in the vicinity of wells, suggesting the last desperate efforts to reach water. Slaves who could not keep up with the caravans, often because their feet had swollen from walking across the hot sands, were abandoned in the desert to die a lingering death from heat, thirst, and hunger. In 1849, a letter from an Ottoman official referred to 1,600 black slaves dying of thirst on their way to Libya. On another route, it was said that someone unfamiliar with the desert might almost be able to find his way just by following the trail of skeletons of people and camels. Widespread loss of life began with the initial slave raids. As late as 1886, an Austrian who was an apologist for slavery nevertheless reported, "Negro villages are burned, all the men killed, and their women and children are taken on months-long, terrible marches." The march from slave-gathering areas, like the region around Lake Chad, across the Sahara Desert to the Mediterranean Sea, took about 3 months, and often only the strongest survived. Other slave routes to Islamic countries were over water, but this meant risking interception by the British Navy, and that in turn often meant that slaves were thrown overboard to drown, rather than being allowed to remain on board to be discovered as incriminating evidence. The Trans-Saharan caravan route was the most deadly, however. It has been estimated that, for every slave to reach Cairo alive, 10 died on the way. Nor was Cairo exceptional. Missionary explorer David Livingstone, among others, estimated that several slaves were captured for every one that reached the Mediterranean alive. Women were particularly vulnerable and were more in demand than men. They brought higher prices in the Islamic countries, where they were widely used as domestic servants or as concubines. Ethiopian women sold for higher prices than Negro women, and white women from the Caucasus brought the highest prices of all. A special danger to men and boys was castration, to produce the eunuchs widely used in Islamic countries for work in the harems. Because the operation was forbidden under Islamic law, it was usually performed early, and often crudely, before reaching areas under the effective control of the Ottoman Empire. An estimated 90% of the men or boys died from the operation, though some groups of slave traders were sufficiently skilled to have much lower mortality rates. Eunuchs brought far higher prices than other slaves. Dead and dying slaves were a common sight in the wake of a slave caravan. David Livingston said that the common incidents of the slave trade that he had seen were so nauseous that I always strive to drive them from memory. For example, one woman, who was unable to carry both her load and young child, had the child taken from her and saw its brains dashed out on a stone. It was not only the Christian missionary Livingston who was shocked by the brutality of Arab slave raiders and traders, so was Muhammad Ali, the ruler of Egypt, who was a battle-hardened military commander. The prime destination of the African slave trade to the Islamic world was Istanbul, capital of the Ottoman Empire, where the largest and busiest slave market flourished. There, women were paraded, examined, questioned, and bid on in a public display, often witnessed by visiting foreigners, until it was finally closed down in 1847 and the slave trade in Istanbul moved underground. In other Islamic countries, however, the slave markets remained open and public, both to natives and foreigners. In 1868, a British captain witnessed the scene at a slave market in Zanzibar. Rows of girls from the age of 12 and upwards are exposed to the examination of throngs of Arab slave dealers and subjected to inexpressible indignities by the brutal dealers. This market functioned until 1873, when two British cruisers appeared offshore, followed by an ultimatum from Britain that the Zanzibar slave trade must cease or the island would face a full naval blockade. This was part of a wider crackdown on the seaborne slave trade in 1873, which caused the trade to become localized rather than to disappear entirely. The treatment of slaves in transit by slave traders often differed from the treatment of slaves at their destinations, but this varied according to both the geographical destinations and the occupational destinations of the slaves. A domestic slave in Istanbul might receive much milder treatment than a plantation slave in East Africa. Although slaves in the Islamic world performed a wide variety of work, pearl divers in the Persian Gulf, seamen in the Indian Ocean and Red Sea, agricultural laborers in Ethiopia or Zanzibar, domestic service was much more common in the Islamic world than in the Western Hemisphere, and plantation labor was much rarer. Wealthier men in the Ottoman Empire often had harems with hundreds of women and substantial numbers of eunuchs to work there. In the Sultan's palaces, black eunuchs worked in the women's quarters while white eunuchs worked in his court. Both sets of eunuchs included leaders who achieved a certain prosperity and influence, or even wealth and power, but of course they perpetuated neither their race nor their culture. Eunuchs were sometimes trusted with high military or civilian posts, on grounds that they had no incentive to try to establish a rival dynasty, nor were they likely to be corrupted from their duties by the seductions of women. While the treatment of slaves by their ultimate purchasers, as distinguished from the slave traders who brought them to market, has been considered generally milder in the Islamic world than in the Western Hemisphere plantation societies, the evidence is much sketchier, for there was no organized anti-slavery movement in the Muslim countries, as there was in Britain, the United States, and elsewhere in Western civilization, to serve as a source of information on abuses of slaves. There was no market in these countries for literature, such as the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, or for the autobiographies of Frederick Douglass and other former slaves. There was in general very little writing about slavery in the Islamic world, where slavery was simply not an issue. Plantation slavery in the Western Hemisphere was not surrounded by walls, and so could be observed by outsiders, many of them critical of the institution of slavery itself and alive to its abuses. What happened behind the walls of Ottoman Empire homes and palaces is much less known. Still less can anyone know today what was in the minds and hearts of those slaves, how they felt about being a degraded people in a foreign land, how a eunuch felt about being deprived of a normal family life, how a concubine felt about being made available without regard to her own feelings, to her owners, or to whomever her owner might give, lend, or sell her. What is known is that there was an extremely low reproduction rate among the Africans enslaved in the Muslim countries. Black women who had children sired by slave owners were sometimes freed, but the magnitude and effect of this phenomenon were not such as to leave a major black population in the region. The story of the African diaspora today is thus largely the story of the descendants of Africans in the Western Hemisphere. The Western Hemisphere. More Africans than Europeans were transported to the Western Hemisphere in the first 4 centuries after Columbus. As of 1820, there had been nearly half again as many Africans as Europeans transported to the Spanish colonies of Latin America, nearly 6 times as many Africans as Europeans transported to Brazil, and about 8 times as many Africans as Europeans transported to the West Indian colonies of Britain, France, Holland, and Denmark. The United States was an exception, but even here, the white majority who migrated to the New World outnumbered the blacks transported involuntarily by less than 20%. For the Western Hemisphere as a whole, about 4 times as many Africans as Europeans arrived in the period up to 1820. However, because of the far higher mortality rates among the slaves, whose numbers could be maintained in most of the hemisphere only by continuing large-scale importations, migration statistics did not match the statistics on the respective resident black and white populations as of a given time. Thus, the resident white population in the United States in 1820 outnumbered the resident black population by more than 4 to 1. In most of the rest of the Western Hemisphere, people of African ancestry still outnumbered people of European ancestry, though not by as wide a margin as among those transported. Over time, rising European immigration and a declining slave trade from Africa changed the demographic picture dramatically. By 1835, the resident white population of the Americas was more than double that of the resident black population. The formal banning of the international slave trade by Great Britain in 1808 did not immediately end the shipment of slaves across the Atlantic. Indeed, it was 1831 before the number of Europeans coming to the Western Hemisphere in a given year exceeded the number of Africans. From that point on, however, the number of slaves transported drifted slowly downward and then dropped precipitously in the 1850s. Conversely, the number of European immigrants rose dramatically, exceeding the Africans by nearly 1/5 in the 1830s, by 4/5 in the 1840s, and then by nearly 20-fold in the 1850s. The European and African populations differed not only racially and in being free and unfree, respectively, but also culturally in at least 2 different senses. In addition to the differences between cultures brought over from Europe and those brought over from Africa, these cultures differed in their survivability in the New World. Particular cultural groups from Europe tended to cluster together in highly localized communities throughout the Western Hemisphere, while Africans on a given plantation were often from culturally diverse areas of Africa and were forced by circumstances, as well as by the whites in charge, to acquire the language of the country in which they now found themselves. Because there were some common denominators among the cultures of West Africa, where most of the slaves in the Western Hemisphere originated, the cultural contrast between the situation of blacks and whites in the New World cannot be carried to extremes, but it was a contrast nonetheless. In some cases, a mixture of slaves speaking different languages and from different cultural backgrounds was deliberately chosen by slave owners as a strategy to reduce solidarity and the risk of conspiracies among the slaves. Slavery in the Western Hemisphere was largely plantation slavery, involving the routine drudgery of growing and harvesting a single crop, such as sugar in the tropics or cotton in the southern United States. Other crops were grown and other tasks had to be performed besides those of the plantation field hands, but the routine, unskilled labor of the field was the primary task of Africans in the New World. Thus, they entered Western civilization at the bottom, acquiring only the rudiments of that culture, such as the spoken language and familiarity with the simplest technology. To varying degrees, they lost the culture they brought over from Africa, without acquiring the full range of European culture. The most extreme examples of this pattern were the blacks in the United States. From as early as the 17th century, most Negroes in the American colonies were born on American soil. This was the only plantation society in the Western Hemisphere in which the African population consistently maintained its numbers without continual large-scale importations of slaves from Africa, and in which this population grew by natural increase. By contrast, Brazil, over the centuries, imported 6 times as many slaves as the United States, even though the U.S. had a larger resident slave population than Brazil, 36% of all the slaves in the Western Hemisphere, as compared to 31% for Brazil. Even such Caribbean islands as Haiti, Jamaica, and Cuba each imported more slaves than the United States. The net result was that more of the African culture survived in other slave societies, where that culture was continually replenished by new arrivals. African languages, for example, were still being spoken in Brazil at least as late as the end of the 18th century. The influence of African music survived throughout the Western Hemisphere, even in the United States, where American Negroes evolved new musical forms from it that became a central part of American popular music in general. The exceptional nature of the American experience is related in part, and perhaps principally, to the geographical distance of the United States from Africa, which made the U.S. the farthest removed of all the plantation slave societies in the Western Hemisphere. It was much easier for Brazil to transport new slaves from Africa than for the United States to do so, the U.S. being so much farther from the source of supply. A slave in the United States in the mid-19th century cost 30 times what he cost on the coast of Africa. American slave owners were very reluctant to lose this kind of investment, so much so that they often hired Irish immigrants to do work considered too dangerous for slaves. Likewise, infant mortality rates among slaves in the antebellum South were a fraction of what they were in the West Indies, much less what they were in countries closer to Africa. In the Caribbean and in Brazil, it was considered to be cheaper to buy new slaves from Africa than to raise local slaves from infancy to working age. This approach meant, among other things, importing more men than women, working slaves harder, even if this reduced their lifespan, and paying less attention to the needs of pregnant women or newborn babies. The much higher mortality rates among slaves in the Caribbean and Latin America reflected these patterns. Brazilian slaves had a declining lifespan, and Jamaica's slave population had a rate of natural decrease ranging from 1.5% to 3.7% annually during the 18th century. Although much has been made of the fact that Latin slave societies tended to have laws more protective of the slave as a human being than the laws of Anglo-American societies, laws were largely ineffective against slave owners throughout the Western Hemisphere. Even the death of a slave from overwork or from brutal whippings was likely to go unpunished. The more fundamental differences in the treatment of slaves were between those societies which could readily and economically replenish their supply from Africa and those which could not. The society least able to do this, the United States, better preserved the lives of existing slaves and paid more attention to pregnant slave women and their newborn babies. Only after the British ban on the international slave trade in 1808 made replacements from Africa less available did the slave population of Barbados begin to reproduce itself, and that of Jamaica began to approach that condition only in the waning years of slavery there. The general demographic makeup of different societies in the Western Hemisphere was likewise reflected in their racial policies. Where the African ancestry population, slave and free, vastly outnumbered the European ancestry population, whether in Latin America or in British colonies like Jamaica, the legal and social gap between slaves and free blacks tended to be widened, and elaborate racial gradations among free persons of color were recognized and different rights assigned to each, all with the effect of fragmenting the African ancestry population in a divide-and-conquer pattern. Where the Europeans were clearly powerful enough to suppress all the African ancestry population, as in Canada and in the American South, then a sharp black and white dichotomy was maintained in law and practice. In turn, this meant that internal color differences among the African ancestry populations of the Western Hemisphere tended to make a greater social difference to the Negroes themselves in Latin America and the Caribbean than in the United States. One consequence of these regional differences in the treatment of different segments of the African ancestry populations were differences in racial solidarity among these geographic regions. For example, it was much more common for free persons of color to own slaves in Latin America and the Caribbean than in the United States. The prime exception in the U.S. was New Orleans, a former Latin American colony acquired in the Louisiana Purchase of 1803, where there was a large class of Negroes owning slaves. One-third of the free colored families in New Orleans owned slaves, and 3,000 free persons of color joined the Confederate Army during the Civil War. Charleston, South Carolina, another exception, had many slave-owning free persons of color from the British West Indies and Santo Domingo. Elsewhere in the United States, where blacks owned other blacks as slaves, it was often only nominal ownership of members of their own family, given the high legal costs of obtaining freedom papers. Some whites, especially Quakers, also held nominal slaves for similar reasons, while those technically in bondage, in fact, lived the lives of free persons. Demography affected the development of Africans in the Western Hemisphere in other ways. Where a rough cross-section of European society was planted to the Western Hemisphere, both men and women, with widely varying skills and spread over a wide range of social and economic levels, there it was possible to confine Africans and their descendants to a narrow range of low-level occupations and roles. This was essentially the situation in the United States. But where a predominantly male group of conquerors and settlers took control of a Western Hemisphere colony, then many more occupations, including those of skilled artisans, had to be filled by non-whites, and sexual liaisons developed with women of both African and Aboriginal ancestry, leading to whole classes of mixed ancestry people, both free and enslaved. This was the situation in much of Latin America and in the Caribbean colonies of various European nations. The proportion of the African ancestry population that was free varied greatly from society to society in the Western Hemisphere. In Jamaica, for example, less than one-tenth of the Negroes were free in the 18th century, and this proportion grew to only 11% on the eve of emancipation in 1834. In Barbados, the slaves outnumbered the free Negroes even more so. Yet, in the Spanish colonies, it became common for the free persons of color to outnumber the slaves. In Argentina, Mexico, Peru, and Puerto Rico, for example, and for Spanish America as a whole, though not in Cuba until the late 19th century. However, in much of Spanish America, slavery itself was not a large-scale institution, nor Negroes a significant proportion of the population. In the Portuguese colony of Brazil, where slavery was indeed a major institution, the free colored outnumbered slaves in some provinces, but not all. In the French colony of Martinique, slaves outnumbered free persons of color, but in another French colony, Santo Domingo, it was just the reverse. While freedom and slavery are a stark dichotomy, in many Western Hemisphere societies, there were in fact important gradations of freedom on a continuum between these polar extremes. The plantation field hand, working under the direct threat of the lash, was at one end of this continuum. Domestic slaves in general, and urban slaves in particular, had some respite from the worst oppressions of slavery, as well as opportunities to become familiar with European culture at a somewhat higher level. They could, for example, hear the language of the country as spoken by a higher class of people, rather than as spoken by semi-literate white overseers. Some domestic slaves could surreptitiously learn to read and write, though literacy was expressly forbidden to slaves in Western Hemisphere societies. Urban slaves, on their own, often found employers to work for, giving part of their pay to their owners in exchange for the privilege of living virtually as free persons. Finally, the free person of color was not fully free, being subjected to many petty and sometimes humiliating legal requirements which did not apply to whites. While slave populations in the Western Hemisphere were often more male than female, especially on the sugar plantations in the tropics, the free persons of color were more female than male throughout the hemisphere. This reflected a tendency of women to be set free more readily than men, often after bearing a child by a slave owner or overseer. Thus, free persons of color tended to differ from the enslaved African population, not only in legal status, but also in skin color, cultural exposure, and sex ratios. Plantation field hands were the least likely to be freed or to escape successfully. House servants, urban slaves, or skilled artisans among the slaves were more likely to be able to earn money or the gratitude of whites, or to form personal ties across racial lines, all of which could be useful in ultimately gaining freedom. Moreover, existing slaves of mixed ancestry were more likely to be given such coveted jobs. Some of the more privileged ones were sometimes only nominally in bondage. Blanche K. Bruce, who was later to become the first Negro senator in the Reconstruction era, was in childhood tutored alongside his white master's son, or other son, according to those who suspected that his master was also his father. Nominal slaves were not uncommon, nor was it uncommon for them to be mulattoes. In antebellum Savannah, for example, two of the churches in the free Negro community were headed by ministers who were among the most prosperous members of that community, even though they were, legally speaking, slaves. The extent to which the free persons of color were of mixed ancestry varied from society to society, but it tended always to be greater than the extent to which slaves were of mixed ancestry. In the United States, 37% of the free Negroes were officially classified as mulattoes, compared to only 8% among the slaves. This did not mean that all other Negroes were of unmixed African ancestry, for the term mulatto was often used narrowly in the United States to mean half-white or more, omitting many other people of mixed African and European ancestries. But whatever the term mulatto meant in different countries, it applied far more often to the free Negroes than to those in bondage. In Brazil, for example, the great majority of free Negroes were mulattoes, and the great majority of the slaves were black. More than half of the free persons of color in Barbados and Suriname were also mulattoes. Mulattoes commonly had a higher official status in slave societies of the Western Hemisphere, except in the United States, where the black-white dichotomy was what mattered in law and practice, though even in the United States there were informal advantages for mulattoes. Some free persons of color prospered, and, especially in Latin America, passed into the white population, but most did neither. Nevertheless, however modest the achievements of most free Negroes, they had a very sizable head start over enslaved blacks in literacy, acculturation, and experience as free people responsible for managing their own lives. In addition, they were more likely to have skills, money, or connections, even if on a modest scale. Education and acculturation in general spread very unevenly among American Negroes, first reaching the house servants and later the field hands, first the free and then the slaves, first the mulattoes and then the blacks. These large historic social disparities within the African origin population of the United States were reflected in the fact that some American Negroes graduated from college before slavery was abolished, while Negroes in the United States as a whole averaged no more than a sixth grade education as late as 1940. In the middle of the 20th century, most of the Negro professionals in Washington, D.C. were by all indications descendants of the antebellum free persons of color, a group that was never more than 14% of the American Negro population. Social, economic, and cultural disparities within the African ancestry population of the Western Hemisphere were also reflected in a social separation that took generations or even centuries to erode. In Peru, as early as the 17th century, locally born Negroes worshipped separately from African-born Negroes, and then even the locally born separated again into mulatto and black congregations. Throughout the era of slavery, free mulattoes in the Western Hemisphere tended to distance themselves socially from blacks, both slave and free. Although such openly acknowledged color consciousness was not as common in the African ancestry population of the United States as in South America and the Caribbean, nevertheless, the elite among American Negroes tended to remain, for generations after emancipation, a distinctly lighter complexioned and socially exclusive group. In 19th century Philadelphia, for example, 85% of mulatto men married mulatto women, and 93% of black men married black women. Moreover, Even when mulatto women married black men, these were usually black men in the top occupations among people of African ancestry. Conversely, when black women married mulatto men, as fewer than 3% of black women did, these mulatto men were more often from the bottom occupational categories. Both patterns reflected the superior social status accorded to lighter-skinned people within the Negro community. More than skin color differences were involved, however. Crime rates were higher and housing poorer in the black neighborhoods than in the mulatto neighborhoods, and a smaller percentage of black children attended schools than was the case among mulatto children. A larger proportion of mulattoes worked in higher-level occupations and averaged larger amounts of wealth. Philadelphia was not unique in any of these respects. In antebellum Savannah, for example, the most prosperous individuals among the free persons of color were mulattoes, and these tended to marry other mulattoes, rather than the darker members of the free Negro population. Marriages between slave and free Negroes were more common in Savannah than marriages between mulattoes and blacks. For generations to come, all across the country, north and south, the elite of the American Negro community tended to be lighter in complexion than the masses, and to be very self-conscious and sometimes snobbish about that fact. They, as well as whites, often attributed their success to Caucasian genes, rather than to historical circumstances and cultural opportunities. Underlying these social phenomena was an economically very consequential transfer of valuable human capital, varying according to prior social and biological relationships with the white population from which this human capital came. In New Orleans during the Reconstruction era after the Civil War, 91% of Negro politicians were mulattoes, in some cases more accurately described as quadroons or octoroons, people with only 1/4 or 1/8 African ancestry. When light-skinned and dark-skinned Negro soldiers were separated for mental testing in one of the U.S. Army camps during the First World War, the darker Negroes turned out to have higher rates of illiteracy and the lighter-skinned Negroes to score higher on mental tests. Nor was this an isolated result. A comprehensive survey of mental test results among American Negroes found that those of visibly mixed ancestry tended to score higher than those of apparently unmixed African ancestry. This correlation between skin color and other social qualities was not merely a perception or an arbitrary stereotype, but a fact. That this fact may be explained historically by one group's earlier and better access to higher levels of European culture rather than by genetics did not prevent it from being a fact nevertheless. Very real behavioral differences, as well as snobbery and vanity, underlay a tendency of the more fortunate and lighter-skinned segment of the African ancestry population to separate itself from the black masses. Such differences within the African ancestry population were not limited to the United States, nor had such differences disappeared entirely by the late 20th century. In Brazil, as late as 1980, blacks and browns were almost as residentially segregated from one another in Brazilian cities as blacks were from whites, and more so than browns from whites. While the degree of urban residential segregation in general was not as great in Brazil as in the contemporary United States, the historic differences within the African ancestry population of Brazil were similar and similarly persistent, not only as regards residential patterns, but also as regards marriage patterns. As with other groups around the world, historic head starts have had enduring consequences. Long after general emancipation erased the legal distinction between free persons of color and the masses of blacks, their respective descendants continued to show large gaps in achievement. For example, it would be 1900 before the Negro population of the United States as a whole reached the level of literacy achieved by the free persons of color in 1850, and it was 1940 before American Negroes as a group would be as urbanized as the free persons of color were in the middle of the 19th century. The aftermath of slavery. After enduring for thousands of years on every inhabited continent, the institution of slavery was obliterated throughout the Western Hemisphere in a period of little more than half a century. Brazil was the last nation in the hemisphere to abolish slavery in 1888, a quarter of a century after Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation in the United States, and just over half a century after slavery was abolished in the British colonies. Remarkable as the abolition of slavery was, its social consequences were not so readily abolished, and in fact endured for generations. While the Civil War ended the legal distinction between slave and free people of African ancestry in the United States, it did not end these internal social divisions. Color stratification, in fact, tended to become more rigid now that vast numbers of newly emancipated blacks demographically swamped the free persons of color who were determined not to be swamped socially as well. New Orleans, with its Caribbean cultural heritage, was and remained the most extreme example of internal social stratification by color. But internal social exclusiveness based on skin color also remained important among Negroes in Chicago at least as late as the 1940s, and in Washington, D.C., even after World War II. Both conservative apologists and radical critics of Western civilization have attempted to make the case that the institution of slavery made an important contribution to the economic and cultural development of the West. It has been claimed, for example, that the slavery of ancient times made possible the classical culture of Greece and Rome. However, it would be extremely difficult to sustain such a case for the slavery of the past five centuries, for which evidence is more abundant. No nation in the Western Hemisphere, and perhaps no nation anywhere in history, so prodigally consumed so many millions of slaves as Brazil. Yet, when Brazil became the last nation in the hemisphere to abolish the institution of slavery in 1888, it was still an economically underdeveloped country. Its later industrial and commercial development was largely the work of European immigrants, who accomplished a more general and enduring transformation of the Brazilian economy within two generations than had occurred during centuries of slavery. The most economically developed parts of Brazil, indeed the industrial heartland of all Latin America, are precisely those areas in the southern regions of the country settled by immigrants from Germany, Italy, and Japan. Even in the late 20th century, the less developed northeastern region of Brazil continued to have a non-white majority, while the more developed and more prosperous regions continued to have a white majority. Similarly, in the United States, the regions where slavery was most heavily concentrated tended to be the most economically backward regions, whose white populations seldom had as high incomes as in states where slavery had never been a major institution. In Europe, it was the nations in the western region of the continent, where slavery was abolished first, that led the continent and the world into the modern industrial age. Racial oppression was another legacy of Western society and of slavery. The Islamic countries were never as racist as the Western world, though they became more racist than before, after their large-scale importation of African slaves. Among Western Hemisphere nations, racial oppression was at its worst in the United States, especially in the former slave states of the South. Lynchings of Negroes peaked at 161 per year in 1892 in the United States, while this phenomenon remained unknown in Latin America and the Caribbean. Brazil, in particular, has long been noted for more relaxed race relations than the United States, and, despite later revisions of Brazil's image as a country completely free of racism, it clearly has had far less racial oppression than the United States. This makes all the more striking the fact that Brazil has had larger black-white disparities in education than the United States, and Brazilians of African descent showed less upward mobility than Americans of African descent. As of 1976, the average income of mulattoes in Brazil was approximately half of white income, and that of blacks barely more than one-third. By contrast, the Negro or African American average income in the United States was more than half that of white Americans decades earlier. As of the same year, 1976, black men in the United States were earning three-fifths of the income of white men, while black women were earning 91% of the income of white women. Clearly, this was the opposite of what would be expected on the assumption that racial discrimination is the crucial factor in economic progress. However, this apparent anomaly is much more readily understandable in terms of human capital differences between the African origin populations of the two countries. American Negroes, being predominantly native-born even in colonial times, became the most culturally Europeanized of all African origin populations in the world, and the most prosperous. The contrast between blacks in Haiti and those in the United States makes the same point even more sharply. Haitian blacks, having been independent of whites for more than two centuries, should be the most prosperous in the hemisphere, and American blacks the poorest, if racial oppression accounts for poverty. But in fact, their respective economic positions are directly the reverse, again suggesting that human capital has a greater effect than racial oppression. The advantages of those Africans who acquired European cultures are demonstrable in many other ways as well. Even during the era of slavery, blacks who returned to Africa from Brazil were more in demand than Africans reared in the indigenous culture, and their descendants continued to be prominent among the African elite in Nigeria, for example. American Negroes who settled in Liberia in the early 19th century maintained an ascendancy and even a despotic rule over indigenous Africans for more than a century, until overthrown in a coup in 1980. Among indigenous Africans in Africa, those more in contact with Europeans, whether in ports, capital cities, or missionary schools, advanced economically much more rapidly than their compatriots in the remote countryside, not only during the period of European colonialism, but also long afterward in the era of independence. Most of the leaders of the newly independent African nations were men educated in Europe or the United States and thoroughly westernized. Even when they promoted Pan-Africanism, for example, they were promoting a kind of thinking found in Europe, like Pan-Slavism or Pan-Germanism, but wholly foreign to the indigenous cultures of Africa, with their heavy emphasis on community, family, and tribal ties. Because Africans in the Western Hemisphere diaspora were introduced to European culture through the institution of slavery, it is difficult to disentangle the effects of slavery from the effects of European culture itself. Most Africans enslaved in the Western Hemisphere were introduced only to the lowest levels of European culture, only what they needed to know to function as plantation field hands. Indeed, laws and practices throughout the hemisphere attempted to prevent their acquiring such rudiments of Western civilization as the ability to read and write, much less such higher values as concepts of human freedom and dignity. Nevertheless, by one means or another, Africans in the Western Hemisphere began the long and slow ascent toward the higher levels of European culture on their own. By the middle of the 19th century, most free persons of color in the United States could read and write, and, half a century after emancipation, so could more than half the entire Negro population of the country. This has been called an accomplishment seldom witnessed in human history. The peoples of Yugoslavia, for example, achieved 52% literacy only in the 1920s, and four-fifths of Albanians were still illiterate at that time. India, near the end of the 20th century, had yet to reach the level of literacy achieved by black Americans at its beginning. Although continuing black-white differences in income, occupations, and other social indicators have been widely attributed to racial discrimination, the experience of black immigrants from the Caribbean in the same society undermines this explanation. As of 1990, the median household incomes of immigrants from Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, and Tobago all equaled or exceeded that of Americans in general. Selective migration may well have led to an atypical sample of the people of these societies living in the United States. However, the point here is not to compare the blacks of the Caribbean with blacks in the United States, but to compare the theory that racial differences in income are due to discrimination with factual data. Summary and implications. At the heart of the history of modern Africa, and of much of the Third World, has been an enormous disparity in wealth, technology, and resulting power between the imperial nations of Europe and the peoples of the colonized regions. The magnitude of this disparity enabled various European nations to overcome even desperate struggles of Africans to remain independent by exerting a relatively minor portion of their total resources, acquiring vast areas of Africa that were, in most cases, of minor economic significance in the Europeans' overall scheme of things. As a scholarly study of wars over the past three centuries has noted, the casualties and costs of 1 year of a colonial war were often less than those of 1 month of a European war. Africa was, of course, of great importance to Africans, and sometimes to particular European colonial officials, missionaries, and business interests involved there. But to Europeans in Europe, it was simply another part of their world empire, and to government officials, especially in Britain, a major concern was that it not become a nuisance or a drain on the treasury. The British policy of indirect rule through local native authorities and indigenous institutions, modified to suit colonial purposes, was one result of the desire to minimize expenditure for a given amount of control. In most cases, with such exceptions as the White Highlands of Kenya or the White Settler Societies in Rhodesia and South Africa, there was no thought of establishing a transplanted European society in African countries, as in North America or Australia. But while indirect rule was a mere expedient to Europeans, it profoundly affected the institutions, society, and futures of the colonized peoples. Often, traditional native authorities with limited powers, and with traditional checks against those powers, became little autocrats when backed by the seemingly invincible force of the imperialist nation. Whites on the scene could be even bigger autocrats. Moreover, low-budget imperialism required the nipping in the bud of ideas, individuals, and movements, which might, if unchecked, later necessitate the costly use of troops and war materiel to maintain control. Another expedient of low-cost imperial control was the mystique of the white man, over and beyond what spontaneous racism would produce. While effective for many years, the mystique of the white man was also vulnerable to any major revelation of his human frailties and shortcomings. The house of cards nature of European imperialism in Africa became apparent with the rapid spread of independence in the 1960s. Few of these African nations had to wage the kind of desperate warfare for independence waged by George Washington or Simon Bolivar to achieve independence in the Western Hemisphere. When low-cost suppression failed in Africa, imprisoned African leaders were, in more than one country, simply released from custody and installed at the head of independent states by imperialist governments which, in most cases, did not find the matter worth major warfare. In those exceptional cases where independence came only after bitter, bloody, and protracted struggles, in Kenya, Algeria, or Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, for example, the key resistance to independence came from European settler communities in Africa, rather than from economic interests within the imperial nations themselves. This is part of a larger pattern of especially bitter relations between indigenous peoples and foreign settlers who refuse to be dislodged from what is also the land of their birth, or to accept rule by the conquered indigenes, with whom they share a history of mutual distrust and hostility. Ulster County in Ireland and Israel's West Bank are other examples, showing that neither large economic interests nor color differences are essential to this phenomenon. Although Africans have had patterns common to other conquered peoples, they have also been distinctive in some ways. Unlike either the American colonies or Britain under the Roman Empire, African countries were in most cases neither replicas of the imperial society nor truly integrated into its legal system or social traditions. Though many newly independent African nations imitated the outward forms of Western democratic societies, the relatively brief period of Western rule could hardly have replicated the centuries of tradition which made democratic institutions viable in Europe and in European offshoot societies overseas. Few of these democratic institutions survived for long after independence in Africa. The economic achievements of Europe were likewise not readily transferable to Africa, partly because of the severe geographical and climatic handicaps which long retarded economic, cultural, and political development in many parts of the continent. Moreover, the relatively brief history of Africa's exposure to European culture made widespread economic replication of European economic progress no more likely than replication of European democracy. Nevertheless, to some extent, European culture did have an effect on Africans. This limited transfer of culture took place in many ways, ranging from unconscious influence to formal study. However, despite an obvious desire in many newly independent African nations to imitate the West, by building industrial manufacturing plants, for example, little of the science, technology, or organizational management skills of the Western world were transferred to Africans. Although many Africans destined to become leaders of their countries spent years, and in some cases decades, living and studying in Europe or the United States, what they brought back from the West were not the practical or scientific knowledge and skills behind the wealth and power of the West, but rather the social theories and moral speculations of European and American intellectuals. Much of the painful history of the first quarter of a century of African independence was a history of African leaders, without the practical knowledge or experience of either Africa or the West, attempting sweeping social experiments on their own people, based on the untested theories of Western intellectuals. The results were often catastrophic. The entire period of a quarter of a century, beginning in 1965, averaged negative growth in output per capita in Uganda, Tanzania, Chad, Zambia, Ghana, Senegal, Madagascar, Zaire, Niger, Benin, and the Central African Republic. This meant that many Africans were poorer after a generation of independence than they had been under imperialist rule. After economic debacles, social tragedies, political repressions, and often brutality and bloodshed, some of these countries and their leaders began to change course in the 1980s, freeing up their economies from statist controls and thus tapping the initiative and energies of their own people, leading to economic upturns in economically devastated countries like Nigeria and Ghana. By 1997, perhaps a dozen African countries were growing at 5% per year or better. These upturns suggest that a belated appreciation of pragmatism was beginning to replace the initial fascination with grandiose visions and soaring rhetoric that marked the beginning of the era of independence in Africa. Nevertheless, even in the last decade of the 20th century, economic growth in Africa as a whole lagged behind that of many other countries in percentage terms, as well as absolutely. However, Africa was not unique in this. The degree of freedom has been found to be correlated with the rate of economic growth for nations in general. For most of Africa, freedom for the people remained an aspiration 3 decades after national independence was achieved. What African nations now had, however, that they did not have at the time of independence, was first-hand experience of what kinds of policies produced what kinds of results. Much of this experience was bitter, but an enlightening and potentially valuable heritage as well. As a study of this era concluded, 30 years of experience should not be dismissed lightly.